I gotta go get a cup of water because I realized I don't have one here. So hang on a second. I'll be back. Play some fish. I'll be back in a second.
Oh, God, no, please don't.
We learned a lot more about the MacBook Pros and everything this week. And honestly, I feel like we spent too much time on it. But the news is so big that we do need to talk about a few angles of it. and it's the kind of news that whenever there's like a new, like brief little scandal about a new Apple product, that news is relevant for like a week. And then after that, the value of it is basically zero.
Except for the keyboard, which has had like a 3-year life now.
Well, because they haven't fixed that. Like, it's one thing like when they fix it.
You never know.
Have they?
I guess we don't know. But yeah, like when they fix it, then it becomes like, then the value of like the scandal that happened is basically zero. So like it's rough that we have to like spend like pretty much 3 shows talking about this, but there's a bunch of angles in this that are kind of interesting. I've learned a lot about this, and so I hope we can provide some value besides, hey, there was a problem and now it's fixed.
Yeah, you know, it's been weird because we caught the drama with regard to the brand new i9. Is it i9 or i7? I'm having a brain fart.
Well, I mean, technically it's all of them, but the one caused the most drama was the i9.
Okay, I'm not crazy. Anyway, so we recorded just after that all broke, and in the time between we recorded and now, when we're recording again, it's basically all blown back over. But we'll talk more about that.
Our timing was perfect, I think. Actually, that's true. These crises were perfectly timed for our recording, so thank you, Apple.
Yeah, actually, yeah, I agree. Like, because the big fix came out was yesterday, was it? And we actually are perfectly timed to talk about this in a way that is probably complete, that has a decent amount of informingness to it, information to it. because last week we were kind of in the middle of it. Like, we had seen the videos and Reddit posts that like, there's a problem with the new MacBook Pro, we think. And we could speculate a whole bunch on what that was. And we could say, I spouted off about like what should and shouldn't be the case. Now we have the information to actually, like, now we have way more information than last time. We'll get to that. So I guess let's end this preamble for now. We'll get to that. But suffice to say, I know this is a lot to talk about the new MacBook Pro and its weird throttling thing. But I think we have value to add. I will try to keep it brief.
With that in mind, everyone, look at your timestamps now. All right. So to start off, let's do some of the more mundane things. It turns out that it is easier to replace the keycaps on the brand new keyboards. From this small website I've never heard of called 512 Pixels, an Apple service document tells us that the keyboard buttons is the word I'm looking for. They're easier to replace, and the membrane is, quote, to prevent debris from entering the butterfly mechanism. Be careful not to tear the membrane. So that's good news, and hopefully it works.
You tried to combine 2 follow-up items there. What are you doing?
I'm following the show notes, man. What do you want from me?
That's a violation, sir.
That's right. Boy, you violated the indenting.
Oh, my God.
Just for a reason. It's like Python. Significant white space.
Oh, God. John, why are you? I thought only Merlin got bad cop John. Now I'm getting bad cop John.
There's no such thing as bad cop John.
Yeah. I mean, you messed with follow up, Casey. I mean, what do you expect?
Oh, my word.
The easier keycap replacement, I think, is a good move. Like, independent of the, you know, the reliability of the keyboard or how you like it or whatever, being able to fix just one keycap is a smart thing to do. And again, we're three years into this keyboard now, starting from the 2015 MacBook. The fact that they went 3 years with a keyboard where if a keycap like pops off or something that you have to replace the entire keyboard, it just seems like not a smart move from a like cost and repairability perspective, right? So I'm glad that they've addressed that, because it's just, you know, it's such a shame to see there's nothing actually wrong with my keyboard, but like I dropped something on it and it broke this one keycap off. Well, top case replacement, like that used to be the answer. So now that you have a fighting chance, Apple repair people have a fighting chance of fixing your keycap by itself. Although you have to be careful not to tear the little membrane thing, because the membrane, as iFixit Teardown has shown, is all one piece. So if you tear it, it's not like you can replace just the membrane under that key. It's just one giant thing. So you need a whole new top case. And the second thing was like, I mean, we talked about this last week. I just wanted to put it in here for confirmation, like that Apple just said the keyboard is quieter, but they had a patent about keeping debris out. and the patent looks like the keyboard, so presumably that thing is not there to make it quieter, it's to keep stuff out. Apple's own documentation, its internal documentation for its like service guide or whatever, says the keyboard has a membrane under the keycaps to prevent debris from entering the butterfly mechanism. It's right from Apple's mouth. So if anyone still had any question whether the membrane was there to make it quieter or to keep debris out, Apple has settled that once and for all.
Yeah, that's like, and we have another follow-up item here that I'd like to also read. This was from Josh Fenton, because this is related to this. You know, when Apple issued the release of these new MacBook Pros, and they said this new keyboard design is quieter, and everyone's like, well, does it fix the, you know, dust killing it thing or not? And it was, you know, it's pretty clear now that Apple was kind of BSing us on that. Like, yeah, I guess it is a little quieter, maybe, but people are like straining to hear the difference. Meanwhile, both Apple's support documents now and, you know, iFixit teardowns and things confirm that this is not really to be quieter. It's really there for this, you know, ingress prevention. So obviously that's the real reason it's here. And Apple was kind of BSing us. One of the reasons why people speculated, that, including us, why they might be, you know, not saying why this is actually here, is that there are a number of class action lawsuits about the keyboard failure. And so people are speculating, you know, maybe they didn't want to say that it's quieter or say that it fixes this problem, because that would admit fault that there is a problem in the first place. And we got a nice email from Josh Fenton, who is a lawyer, saying that there's a legal doctrine that prohibits introducing subsequent remedial measures as evidence of the existence of a previous negligence or design defect. So the idea is, you couldn't make a legal, according to this doctrine, it is not a valid legal argument to say you definitely had a defect before because the new product changed in this way to make this thing better. And Josh Fenton says, while kind of intuitive, this doctrine exists in support of a public policy that the law should not serve as a disincentive for people or companies to improve the safety and quality of their products, services, or premises. Because it's kind of, you know, that would be kind of counterintuitive and kind of, you know, damaging over time. So I don't know. I mean, chances are Apple is being exceptionally conservative and not even wanting to try to have to invoke this kind of doctrine. Like, they probably want as much immunity as possible against these lawsuits. So this doesn't say, like, you know, they don't have to come out and say that this is fixed, but, you know, it does seem like they have less legal reason than we predicted to avoid saying that this is fixed because of ingress.
So if that's true, what's left is what people were thinking before, which is pride. As in corporate pride, or like, why would we admit that we ever did anything wrong? Why don't we just say, we have a new keyboard, it's great, best keyboard we ever made, and it's quieter, and just don't answer any questions about, you know, reliability, right? Because if it's not legal, keeping their mouth shut, it's a worse look. Because if it was a legal thing, like, whatever, lawsuits are weird. And maybe, you're right, maybe it still could be an abundance of caution, and who knows if there's some specific case law related to this or whatever. But if the legal reasons are taken out of the equation, the only thing left is, like, I think a PR miscalculation, perhaps, because it looks better when you say we had a problem and we fixed it and the new ones are great. And it's not like they're not admitting they had a problem, because they do have the repair extension program, and you don't do that just for the hell of it. You don't do a repair extension program on a keyboard that has perfect reliability, right? There's obviously a problem, and yet still somehow they could not bring themselves to say this new keyboard is more reliable.
Going back to the keyboard and these membranes, iFixit did some really interesting work with regard to testing whether or not the membrane does anything. So they have this post, which we'll link to, where they did a few things to kind of figure out, does this make a difference? And what they did was they sprinkled blue powder on top of the keys, used them for a while, and then popped off the keycaps to see, okay, where is this blue powder? And the conclusion they seem to come to is that, yeah, it definitely helps.
I think the most relevant part of this test, though, is so they did this the glowy sand, which is like very, very fine. It's kind of cool because you can track where it is and everything, and showing that it mostly keeps it, you know, and an important part is, I think they compared it to one without the membrane. Say without the membrane, it's all over the place, and with the membrane, it's mostly on the edges. Good, right? But then they took a little bit of sand and put it on, and it wedged the keys like instantly. Yeah, because there are holes in the membrane. There are big holes where the hinges come through. So it's not like sand can't get in, and it's not like sand has to sneak in through a tiny opening. The openings are pretty big. So still, you should really avoid getting sand on your keyboard. The good news, as we mentioned before, is if you do get a piece of sand under your keyboard, there's a chance that they can pop off the keycap, take out the sand, and put the keycap back on, and you don't have to have all top case replacement. But, you know, like I said, if you're going to make some kind of barrier to keep grit out, and there are five giant holes under every key where grit can get in, it's only so much you can do. So probably improved, probably better, but maybe don't use your MacBook Pro on the beach.
you know, it's too early to know whether in practice this will actually reduce the occurrence of the keyboard problems. But it is kind of nice that they did this test. It is kind of nice to know we aren't totally out of the woods on this. Like, if you have one of these, you still can't, like, you know, eat a muffin on top of it without running a pretty big risk there. You're simply, you have a reduced risk. But in a way, I also think, like, you know, Casey, you've had with your MacBook One, you've had, you know, a lot of compressed air adventures, as Apple recommends, like trying to get, you know, your one piece, trying to move around the piece of dust that gets under the key so it goes to a different key. I think with this, that's probably not going to work. With this, I think the dynamic here will be that it is harder for things to get in, but it's even harder for anything to ever get back out. So if something does get in, which is, as John said, which is still possible, it's just less likely. But if something does get in, I bet you're done. I bet that's it. You have no recourse. It's nice that they're making this better. I hope in practice it's going to be so rare, because, you know, iFixit said they had to, like, try pretty hard to finally get something in it. Like, they had to, like, you know, really blast it with sand, I think. So it was, I hope that in practice it's not going to be a problem. But they still have a keyboard that if a piece of dust gets in the wrong spot, it will kill it. They just have made it less likely for that to happen. So progress, but not probably completely out of the woods.
I put a thing in the thing I put in the show notes is that they didn't actually have to try hard with the sand. Like, this is a quote directly from the thing. We sprinkle a pinch of sand over the keyboard, type on the keys for a minute, and we don't even have to lift the keycaps to realize that something is wrong. A few keys have seized up. So it wasn't actually that hard with sand.
Oh, that's not good.
I don't know what to think about this. I do think that listening to Marco, I've come up with the official unofficial name for this keyboard, which is the Hotel California keyboard, where you can enter but you can never leave.
It's a Roach Motel. I was going to make the Roach Motel joke, but you tried to make the Hotel California. I think the Roach Motel is better, but that may be before your time.
No, it is slightly before our time. But second of all, come on. Hotel California is so good. Anyway,
that's fantastic.
All in the chat room has an interesting question, which I think we should cover real quick before we move on. Do you guys think this is an acceptable solution? And taking that word specifically, acceptable, I think this is acceptable. I'm not in love with it. I think that everyone is still worried about keyboard reliability, in part because we haven't really heard what the reliability is like. You know, these machines have only been in people's hands for, what, a week, 2 weeks? But it's enough. Well, I feel like it's acceptable. It is enough to make me think it's worth trying these new keyboards if you've had a problem in the past. But it certainly seems like the Achilles heel status of these keyboards hasn't changed. And that's a problem. And it's also tough because, you know, I've been going back and forth between my MacBook Adorable and my full Darth Vader, you know, 104 whatever key wireless keyboard. And although I do love this Magic Keyboard that Apple makes, and I've said that many, many, many times on the show, I still like the feel of my Adorable a little bit more, which is weird because I never thought I'd like anything more than this Magic Keyboard. So it's acceptable, but I feel like time will tell to see if it's really enough. I don't know. Marco, obviously you have thoughts on this, so let's start with John, and then Marco, maybe you can bring us home afterwards.
So what was the question again? Is it acceptable?
So do you guys think this is an acceptable solution?
I don't really know what acceptable means. I think the question the question for me is, would I like recommend these laptops to people, right? Like, is, you know, say, yeah, you go ahead and buy one, they're good, like, it's okay, they fix the keyboard things. And the answer to that is I the jury's still out as far as I'm concerned. Like, I don't know yet, it's too early. It would make me more comfortable, surprisingly. Like, I know they're not going to do this, but like, if these were included in the repair extension, just because you have this keyboard and it's supposed to be better about reliability, and it probably is, but if it isn't, I don't want to pay for a new top case after a year, right? It's almost like the 2017 and 16 and 15 models have the assurance that, like, well, you get one, and if you do have a problem, don't worry, they'll cover it for 4 years, right? And that's probably how long your laptop will last anyway before the battery's hosed. Whereas this one, it's like, oh, that problem's probably gone, so you're probably fine. But if it turns out the problem isn't gone, and again, with the sprinkling of sand, we see that it actually isn't entirely gone under the worst possible conditions. Oh, someone spilled some sand on your laptop, right? And you typed on it for 2 seconds. And I don't want to be stuck having to replace it. So it's, you know, it's an improvement. It's better. I particularly like the idea that you can replace a keycap without replacing the whole keyboard. That, I think, is a big possibility. Like, you won't have to pay for a whole new top case. You'll just bring it in. Yeah, it's annoying, but you got some sand under your keyboard. They'll pop it off, give you a new keycap, or you break a keycap by dropping something heavy in your keyboard and they can fix it. But I feel like it's not, it's still not up to the bar of the 2015, which is basically a keyboard that, you know, I'm sure people had problems with it and people broke keycaps off and stuff like that, but it wasn't, it didn't raise to the level of like, you know, some high percentage of people, you know, with 2015 MacBook Pros had one or more keyboard problems. Like, you just, no one ever talked about the keyboard. It was like the keyboard was the keyboard and whatever. I don't think this one has crossed that bar yet. I feel like it's just the, as we said in past shows, it's just the accumulation of Band-Aids. This is like the maximum number of Band-Aids all piled on top of this little wound, but the scab is kind of still there.
Well said. I think the jury is still out on this. I can't wait for, you know, I did order one of these machines. We can talk about that later if you want. I'll tell you one thing I did when I ordered it. I also ordered one of those silicone covers for the keyboard for like $10 on Amazon.
Oh no.
Because I just don't know. And here's the thing, like, you know, it's basically a $10 insurance policy. Like, I can spend $10 on this stupid silicone cover. This problem might have been solved, but we don't know yet. It sure seems like it hasn't really been fully solved, but maybe it's been improved enough that we'll stop caring. The correct solution to this problem is to design a keyboard that either dust can get in and out freely so that dust getting in for a second isn't a big deal because it can just come right back out again like the old ones, or design a keyboard that dust can't get into at all. You know, like, what if you look at like the design of like the smart keyboard for iPads, where it's basically like a cloth membrane over the whole thing, covering the key, like one big thing over the whole keys, so that even like, you know, you can basically spill water on it and, you know, it doesn't really go in anywhere. I feel like those two extremes are the way to go here. Either make it so dust can come in and out freely, or make it so dust can't get in at all. And they haven't done that yet. As John said, this is still a Band-Aid on this keyboard design. I still really want to know what the next design is. Like, what's the next major keyboard here? This keyboard, they took a lot of risks. They did a lot of crazy things. They optimized for factors I don't give two craps about. Like, great, my keyboard is precise and stable. Two things I have never once pushed the key on any other keyboard and said, this is too imprecise and unstable. I've never had that opinion of anything. So I want to see where they go next.
So would you say it's acceptable? I'm not trying to snark. I'm genuinely asking. Like, I feel like you're kind of on both sides of that. So yes, no, acceptable?
With the caveat that it's still way too early to tell. Sure. Just by the way it looks, like based on iFixit teardown and stuff, and their testing, I give it like a B. Like, this seems like it's probably a decent solution, but it's not the best solution.
Fair enough.
By the way, with your little silicone cover thing, I'm wondering if you have just increased the amount of finger grease that's going to appear on your screen.
We're already past that point.
You're all on board with it.
I fought that for years. Like when I had my very first PowerBook, my first laptop, I was very careful with how I arranged the backpack. I made like a whole custom padded compartment out of black felt so that it was never like squished against. So I told you before my theory about like what causes the keyboard imprint on the screens. When it's closed flat, like on top of a desk, they don't make contact. But if it's compressed slightly in a bag, I think the screen lid flexes slightly inwards, and that compresses the keyboard against the screen. So I think that's where. So it really depends on like what kind of bag you're putting it in, whether anything is on top of it or pushing against it. So I used to care a lot about that. In the last few years, I just started losing that fight more and more as I got like different backpacks and different bags and everything. And now I just don't care anymore.
Yeah, the other thing I noticed with looking at laptops around work is I think it was the 2015s and maybe the couple of years before, like the anti-glare coating would start coming off. Have you seen that?
Oh, yeah. The delamination. Yes.
Yeah, a bunch of the ones at work have it. But surprisingly, it's one of those problems that if you don't, like, people don't notice it until I point it out to them and say, you realize your anti-glare thing is, I don't know if it's the anti-glare or delamination or whatever, but you can tell. It looks kind of like there's like grease on the screen, but it's not grease. It's, you can't clean it off, and it tends to happen around the edges or whatever. But people are like, they shrug. And one of the reasons they shrug is the rest of their screen is covered with finger grease from the keyboard and directly from their fingers. So their entire screens look like a mess anyway, and they're just used to it.
All right, Marco, you have something to smile about, though, because a little birdie has told us something very, very interesting. Can you tell us about this?
Yes. Yeah, so as I've ranted a lot about before, the USB-C ecosystem is just not really panning out. And for me, one of the biggest problems with it, yes, you can convert everything. If you go out and buy all new cables, you can get like all cables that have USB-C on one end and whatever you need on the other end for all your stuff. So you can convert your cables pretty easily, but you can't convert hubs because there doesn't seem to be any kind of actual like USB-C hub that just takes one USB-C port and makes like four other USB-C ports out of it. And you know, there's lots of complexity to the USB-C spec with things like Thunderbolt and DisplayPort and power. It's very, very complex. So making such a thing is apparently very difficult, which is why they don't really seem to exist. There are a few products on the market, like a couple of those like $300 docks that have like two output ports maybe, but that's usually about your only option. And I think USB-C requires hubs that just, you know, take one port to multiple C ports for it to really finally take over. And we've heard from an anonymous person that Intel is finally releasing a hub chip for USB-C next year. So this would be a chip that could be put into hubs. We may not see product on it based products based on it until 2020. I don't know enough about this kind of stuff to say whether this is it, whether this is all we need, whether this is even true or plausible. But typically, the chips that are in USB hubs and Thunderbolt hubs and everything, they tend to be made by very few manufacturers. There's like, you know, that's why you have like a million different brand names on Amazon for what appears to be like about the same hub or like the same kind of thing. It's because there's like one company that makes those chips in there. And usually it's somebody like Intel or VIA or something like that, like, you know, like one of the big chip makers. And so apparently if the chip to make USB-C hubs hasn't really existed yet, that would certainly explain the problem that we have. And if Intel's making one in the next couple of years, that's probably good news. Although I kind of wish it was out now. And I kind of wonder, like, we've had USB-C ports on MacBooks since 2015. Like, what are we waiting for?
Do we want to talk about the history lesson that was also associated with this?
Yeah, I thought this was a good summary because, like, the larger issue, I mean, it's not really related to throttling, but, like, what's the deal with Intel CPUs these days? Like, you know, there's the bigger picture of, like, Moore's Law and everything we've talked about, but, like, Intel CPUs haven't been getting that much faster or that much better in recent years for a variety of reasons. And one of the reasons is that they haven't been able to get their new process, their 10 nanometer process, online. So they've just been making part after part after part out of 14 nanometers. And it's only so much you can do by sort of rearranging the deck chairs. Like, can we add more? I think they're adding even more cores. I think they're going to go 8 cores in the same CPUs that we have 6 cores in now. Because, like, what else can they do? Because they don't have a smaller process. And this sort of semi-brief history, I think, is a good rundown of what the deal was and why Apple might find itself in a difficult situation designing its laptop around these chips. So 2016, when the Skylake MacBook Pros were released, Canyon Lake was supposed to be around the corner in 2017 with an LPDDR4 controller supporting 32 gigs, right? So in 2016, they're like, oh, no problem. Next year, 2017, we'll be able to support 32 gigs with low power. That didn't happen, right? Then Cannon Lake got pushed to 2018. Kaby Lake was inserted, which is just Skylake with HEVC and HDCP 2.2. Then Coffee Lake got added in 2018, which is just Kaby Lake with more cores. And Cannon Lake was canceled. Although this person says, the same anonymous person, yes, really, although Intel hasn't fessed up yet. Now Ice Lake is teetering on the edge of failure, and Intel is prepping yet more 14 nanometer parts for 2019. And here we still are, 14 nanometer with Skylake memory controller. And the new 15-inch MacBook Pro uses the built-in memory controller, which works just fine with DDR4, which is what we're seeing right now. Apple has made plenty of own goals in soccer parlance, football parlance, in the MacBook Pro, primarily due to design hubris. But trying to plan products on Intel's roadmap has become masochistic. Like what do you do if you're going to plan, like, this is the new generation of MacBook Pro, and we're going to design 3 models for the next 3 years, and Intel tells us this is their roadmap, and then they just miss that roadmap entirely and just keep releasing 14 nanometer parts. It's not a great situation to be in. Now, you can argue that the correct choice is to scrap everything and redesign a new case to handle 14 nanometer things, but the lead times might just not have been good enough to do that. So, you know, we're all in the same boat here. It's not like someone else has secret better Intel CPUs than Apple. Apple gets the same ones as everyone else. And Intel really needs to get its process online. And we have a topic about that later, we might get to later, but it's yet another reason why people continue to entertain fantasies of ARM-based Macs, because one thing that has happened in recent years is Apple's ARM CPUs are getting better all the time, and they're really, really good. And, like, every time I go to Geekbench or whatever and look at the scores for, like, the iPhone X versus Apple's MacBooks, like Apple's 2018 MacBooks, they're not that far apart. And I think about exactly how many fans there are in an iPhone X, right? How big it is, how big the battery is. And then I look at the Geekbench scores, and you're like, ARM Macs are looking, you know, I know it's not apples to apples. I know it's not the same. I know it doesn't have 32 gigs of RAM in the phone. Like, I understand. I know it's not a giant monster GPU, discrete GPU in there. But Boy, Intel is really making ARM Macs look more and more attractive every year.
We are sponsored this week by the Aftershocks Bone Conduction Headphones. Go to atp.aftershocks.com to learn more and check out the weightless wireless Trex Air. I love bone conduction headphones, especially in the summertime. Here's why. So any other headphone you have, it's going to be something that either goes on top of your ear or has a big cup around your ear or something that goes into your ear. And I have problems with both of those things. The in-ear ones just hurt me. I just don't have the ears for them. The ones that go around or on your ears are too hot for the summertime. And when you're walking around outside, it's hard to hear things like cars driving by or if someone's trying to talk to you when you're wearing big headphones. Bone conduction headphones solve these problems. First of all, there's nothing in or on or around your ears. Instead, they have these little transducers. They're very small. They have like a little wraparound neck band and these little transducers that rest kind of in front of your ears on your cheekbones. And they send little vibrations that your eardrums pick up as sound, but the world doesn't hear it that way. And in addition, because nothing is blocking your ears, you can still hear the world around you. So it's very practical when you're doing outdoor activities, walking, cycling, even just doing stuff around the house. If you want to hear if someone knocks on the door or if someone else in your house is calling your name, they're incredibly nice. And the Aftershocks Trex Air are just great headphones, too. They're Bluetooth, of course, so they're wireless. They're pretty much weightless. Like they say they weigh like an ounce, but honestly, the weight is nothing. Like you feel it like nothing. Good range, good battery life. There's a great warranty if you need it. They're water resistant, IP55 certified. So if you get caught in the rain or if you're sweating all over them, no big deal. The Trex Air are the only headphones I wear in the summer. I like them so much that this summer I'm testing a lot between my watch app and my phone app. And I wanted two different headphones so I could just grab one that's paired to each device without having to repair them. And I bought a second Trex Air. That's how much I like them. I like them so much I bought a second one. I highly recommend the Aftershocks Trex Air. Check it out today, atp.aftershocks.com. And you can use code ATPBUNDLE to get $55 off of a Trex Air bundle. So once again, atp.aftershocks.com. Use code ATPBUNDLE to get $55 off a Trex Air bundle. Thank you so much to Aftershocks for just making awesome headphones and for sponsoring our show. In one of my big rants last episode on this throttling thing, you know, I've mostly tried to stay out of the i9 throttling thing because I just didn't know much about it. And it was a configuration I didn't have and I couldn't get access to. And it just seemed like it was mostly playing out on YouTube and Reddit. But one of the big, lines I drew in the sand was a CPU should never run below its base clock. Like it should never have to do that in normal operation. It should be able to sustain its base clock indefinitely. And if it can't, there's something seriously wrong with the thermal design around it. And it turns out that was not a complete picture of how things work anymore. So we've learned a lot since the last episode. And so I wanted to go over a few things. First of all, we pointed out last episode the 800 megahertz clock, like where the CPU would drop down to 800 megahertz. Now, in the throttling problem where it would cause like the big sawtooth graph basically of like constant spikes up and down, that actually was the real problem. But sometimes the CPU will drop to 800 megahertz because it's idle. 800 megahertz is simply the lowest clock that the CPU will typically use in just power save mode. It is also used in very extreme cases for throttling for thermal reasons. But if your CPU hits 800 megahertz, that might just be because it wasn't doing that much and it clocked itself down to save power. Secondarily, so going back to a CPU must always maintain its base clock no matter what. Well, it turns out that when Intel's recent AVX instructions are being used, their processors reduce their base clock because AVX instructions are apparently so like heavy duty and complicated to execute that the processors are designed to actually reduce their base clock while running AVX instructions. I honestly don't know that much about AVX, but it's kind of like the continuation of like MMX, like you know back in the early days MMX, and then what were the other ones? There were like a bunch of SSE and all those like extra instructions, like big vector instructions to process lots of data at once. So AVX is like the recent version of that kind of idea.
Doesn't even mention AltaVec, but I'll do it because I have to.
Yeah, your AltaVec really took over the world there, John.
And AltaVec was awesome.
Oh, my word.
So much better than MMX.
So among the valid reasons that a CPU might operate below base clock are either it's saving power because it's idle or it's using AVX instructions, even if it's at full load. And then finally, you know, we talk a lot about the CPU's TDP. I mean, this is a figure in watts, which is the maximum power draw or heat generation. It's kind of the same thing that a CPU will issue. And it turns out my view of TDP and my definition of TDP was outdated. The 15-inch is usually like a 45-watt TDP on those processors, which I thought would mean that at peak load, no matter what, it would not exceed 45 watts of heat output and therefore power usage. It turns out that's not the case. It turns out TDP is the expected maximum average power draw with all cores operating at the base frequency. If Turbo Boost is being used, it can exceed TDP all the time. Like it can exceed TDP constantly. It can do it whenever it wants. TDP is just when Turbo Boost is not being used, when it's the base frequency and all cores are maxed out, that's roughly what you can expect the maximum power output to be. Now, we've been told by people who know more about this than us, thank goodness they exist, that before Coffee Lake, which is this generation, and before Kaby Lake, which is the 2017 generation, there actually used to be a lot more headroom in practice before the CPUs would really hit TDP. Like the TDP figures were apparently very conservative. The CPUs would not normally surpass them much under load, even using Turbo. But as we mentioned a few minutes ago, Intel not being able to get to their 10-nanometer process, get those chips out the door, has had to cram more and more transistors and chips into this old 14-nanometer process, which means that they're cramming more cores and more stuff into the chips without shrinking their process size, which means they're just going to use more power. Simple as that. Like the design of each core hasn't changed substantially to make them more efficient, and there's no process size shrink to give us, you know, a cooling benefit there. So basically, these chips are getting more and more complicated without increasing their efficiency much. So they are using more power. So we didn't just get two cores for free. We got two more cores by basically Intel is now approaching and surpassing the quoted TDP figures much more often. So when a CPU is under load, that 45-watt TDP processor in the 15-inch can use way more than 45 watts. It probably won't sustain it for very long, but it frequently and will easily pull 65 watts. I think somebody even said it could pull 100 watts at max load, like if max turbo is on. Like this is pulling massive amounts of power. It's generating massive amounts of heat, and this is not just the i9 but all of the Coffee Lake CPUs, even down to the 13-inch ones. So basically, everything I knew about both clock speed and TDP was outdated and wrong. I say this because it's something I really am trying to get better at. We want to make sure our hot takes are well informed, and you know, because it's hard because like whenever there's something like this, whenever there is, you know, some kind of big Apple drama, like when that you know annoying guy on YouTube broke his iMac Pro and cleaned up and wouldn't fix it because it was broken, not because he destroyed it. like everyone, whenever anything like that happens, everyone comes to people like us on Twitter and is like, hey, what do you think of this? This is crazy, right? Oh my God. And I try to get a really fast opinion out there because everybody wants it and because I want to give it because I'm excited too. And if Apple has done something wrong, I want to call them on it too. You know, I thought I knew enough about this stuff to be able to say like, this should never happen. XYZ should never happen. And they're wrong. And I just didn't in this case. Like, there's so much about this that's way more complicated than I thought it was. Much, you know, some of it has changed recently. Some of it I just didn't know. And so it's just nice to be able to step back for a minute and try to get a little bit better at not jumping to so many, like, absolute conclusions about this stuff so quickly. So I apologize for doing that so often. I'm trying to get better at that. And this is one example where I think maybe, you know, we could all get a little bit better at that.
So Intel is kind of in a similar situation in that they had existing definitions based on the way their chips used to work. And as things have changed about chips, as they always do, as the process shrinks, the things that used to be steady or, you know, reliable before now become more variable and different things become important. And as they've had to spend more and more time on 14 nanometer, they've had to fudge things just because, you know, you can't get blood from a stone. Like you were saying, you're going to put more cores on. You're not getting that for free. You got to put more area and your things get bigger and they dissipate more heat and there's more transistors and they're the same size as they were before. So where do you think you're getting any savings from? And whatever headroom you had, you're eating it. So a couple of people wrote in to like pull the definitions of like TDP and base clock and stuff from Intel's documentation. And what used to be a straightforward definition is now a little bit more wishy-washy and has more caveats and more special cases, and in some cases is somewhat circular. Like the base clock is the clock that it can maintain while satisfying TDP, and TDP is the power used when it's running at base clock. Like you just go around in circles, but then asterisk, but except for AVX instructions, and it's, as we've seen from the fix, which I think we'll get to in a little bit, there's the whole profile of how the cooling system works and how the hardware deals with changes in load and heat, and how that integrates with the cooling system and what the optimal arrangement is. And it's not just as simple as if CPU gets hot, make cool now, please. Right. There's curves and there's settings, and like, it's very complicated. Right. So it was so much simpler when, you know, there was no turbo boost and the CPU had a speed, and maybe you could overclock it, but either way, just stayed at that speed all the time. And there was no speed step, and there was no, you know, throttling. And it was just, and we still use those same terms and those same sort of measurements and the same conception of how they work. But in this modern age, like I was saying before, with the thin and light laptop, like the over provisioning, like things are more complicated, and everything is trying to some kind of compromise, because you can't have a laptop like this with a CPU like this that behaves like one from a decade ago, where it can run at maximum power all day, and that's how you can measure battery life, right? Everything is a very complicated compromise involving hardware and software management and various curves and specific, you know, loads, specific applications, sets of instructions, just, you know, everything is much more complicated than it used to be. And, you know, I can only imagine what it's like in phones. Like the only reason we don't know about the world that's going inside there is because it's like just a sealed box to us. And, you know, we don't have a history of smartphones where things were replaceable and we could talk about them in this sort of modular way. But on laptops we do, but most of that is out the window now. So it's, we're grappling with it. And so I think is Intel, because they have to sell these things and sell a benefit. And the last thing you want to do when selling a benefit is to explain all the nuances. Like, it's faster under these conditions with these caveats, assuming you do this, that, and the other thing. It's better to just say it's faster, right? And then when people find, but what about this and what about that? And you look at Intel's documentation and says, yeah, no, that's in the docs, but it's very nuanced, and we didn't feel like explaining that to you in the sales brochure.
Yeah, ultimately what this boils down to is the numbers that Intel quotes on the CPUs, like this is a 2.9 gigahertz processor. It basically means nothing. Like, you can't take anything as absolute anymore. Like,
it means it can run faster than the 2.71 or the 2.21. Like, the numbers are still comparable for the most part. Although, it was, sorry, I just saw flyby right before I recorded.
But they aren't even proportional. Like the 2.9 is not, like, you know, 40% or whatever it is faster than the 2.2.
Yeah, well, because you have to look at the turbo things, and they might not be proportional to the base clocks. Well, here's one that makes it even worse. The story I just saw before we recorded is that in the upcoming generation, which I think they're going to go to 8 cores instead of 6, again, on the same process as far as I could tell.
Oh, geez.
They're taking hyper-threading out of the i7s. So now, instead of it being a 6-core, like, 12-thread, it'll be an 8-core, 8-thread. just to confuse you even more. And it should still end up being faster than the old ones, but people are going to run their CPU meters and be like, hey, there's fewer lines. It's just this 14 nanometer forever thing is kind of like the, what the hell was it? A chat room can help me. 533 megahertz front side bus in the G4 for like years and years, even when it was obscene.
So to take a half step back, there was a Reddit post that got really, really popular a few days ago where somebody who strikes me as very intelligent and very well read, and I don't say that sarcastically, had come up with a theory as to why this throttling was happening. And they have since edited their post with some new information, which we'll get to in a minute. But if you scroll down on the link we'll put in the show notes, you'll see where it says original post below. So what they said was they think the problem is the voltage regulator module being unable to satisfy the power desires of the i9 CPU. And they did a bunch of crazy stuff with setting some switches in either the CPU or the VRM in order to get it to not limit the power going to the CPU, which, from what I can tell, having obviously not tried this, seems to have worked if you're willing to disable SIP and install a KEX, a kernel extension, all this other crazy stuff. So that worked reasonably well for a little bit until, I believe it was yesterday, as one of you said earlier, Apple released an official fix. So I don't, I feel like this has been mostly resolved, but do we have any thoughts on this Reddit thread or the fix that came out of Apple just yesterday?
I think the Reddit thread is a good example of like people trying to figure it out on their own. Like they don't know what the problem is, but they can see that we have measurements. We have some tools that we can use. And there's a thing about the tools that we'll get to in a little bit too. But we're like, what's the problem here? What could be the problem? Like, because it's not as simple as, you know, just like an on off switch or like it's always running at maximum cooling. There's lots of decisions to be made. Exactly how much power should the CPU draw for how long? When it turbos, when should it decide to turbo? And when should it say, I've turboed enough, I should go down, right? And there are other chips involved on the motherboard, not just the CPU, that could be involved in a cooling decision. And so someone was just poking in some registers or firmware or something and changing a bunch of hex values in some, you know, big bit mask thing and saying this controls how long it turbos to maximum speed, or how, you know, you're allowed to draw 100 watts for 30 seconds and you're allowed to draw 150 watts for 5 seconds, and just like playing with those numbers with the goal of taking some workload, I forget what they were doing as the workload, and making that workload complete faster, because it's inefficient to bump really hard up against your thermal ceiling and throttle way, way down, and then bump right up back up against it and throttle way, way down. It's much better to oscillate with smaller moves, like turbo for a shorter period so you don't hit your ceiling and don't bump way, way down. And so you can just bump from your base clock up to turbo, base clock up to turbo or whatever. It's better than going from turbo all the way down to like 800 megahertz or whatever. Again, like Mark was saying before, if you know, and they say, oh, it's not actually the CPU, it's the voltage regulation module. And when that overheats, it responds by pulling power from the CPU, and all sorts of theories. And like, there's a lot more going on inside there than you know, anyone outside Apple is probably going to be able to tell. So Apple's fix, as the new updated thread says, doesn't just operate on the CPU, but takes the entire system into account, so it can handle cases where, what if your GPU is making really hot because it's something in your application is using the GPU? Like, it's all the same kind of cooling system inside there, and an excess of heat can make everything hot because it's all next to each other inside the same case or whatever. So Apple's patch takes a more holistic view of the system, as it has, you know, always does, and tries to balance the heat and tries to make the components, you know, not slam hard against their thermal ceiling, but just creep right up to it, but have the cooling system keep them below it and have them oscillate back and forth as you'd expect. So basically saying, if it gets too hot, go back down to your base clock, cool off for a while, and then go, you know. It's some heroic armchair attempts at fixes without access to source code or anything like that, but just access to a machine. But it's, you know, I would never recommend someone do something like that, not the least of which because it requires a kernel extension and disabling system integrity protection, all sorts of other stuff. And if it really is a real problem, you should have some confidence that Apple will do something about it. And in this case, they did within days. So this is a pretty fast turnaround time from Apple, and it's some interesting experiments by people out in the field. But I would warn people, like, if you had one of these, like, you know, give it some time, give it a few days, give it a week. Don't rush out and install software that some person posted on Reddit, even if it might look cool.
Well, but you know, but I think there is some value to the other side of that, of like, you know, when you look at what we mentioned earlier about how, you know, the alleged reason that Apple PR gave for the keyboard membrane was to make this keyboard quieter, when that appears to be pretty, you know, BS-y, right? So whatever Apple says or doesn't say about problems like this, it's hard to know whether it's accurate or not without, you know, people playing around with stuff like this. One of the reasons I was watching this thread was like, all right, so they say that the VRM throttling is at fault here, that basically the thermal settings were not good for that processor, and that changing the thermal settings would fix this problem. So the very first thing I wanted to know when the patch came out was, did they change those settings? Because like with this method, you're like using some utility to read the settings, and then you figure out what the value should be and write new settings back. So I was very, very curious to go back to this thread once that patch was out to see, like, all right, has this person who wrote this like gone back and updated it with the new one? Because if the value has changed with this new, you know, with the patch that Apple released, Apple's reason was, you know, BS, that this is actually the real reason here, that this value is wrong. And it would still be great that they fixed it, but if the value had changed and that was the real reason, that would be like, you know, worth knowing, you know, worth experimenting to find out. Fortunately, that wasn't the case. Fortunately, that, you know, the value has not changed of this VRM profile thing, of like how much heat it can draw for how long. So fortunately, the PR explanation appears to be correct. And we'll get to that, I guess, now.
Indeed. So Apple has released a software fix, and we'll put a link to Jason Snell's coverage on Six Colors. But the quote from Apple is as follows: following extensive performance testing under numerous workloads, we've identified that there is a, quote, this is from them, a missing digital key in the firmware that impacts the thermal management system and could drive clock speeds down under heavy thermal loads on the new MacBook Pro. A bug fix is included in today's macOS High Sierra 10.13.6 supplemental update and is recommended. We apologize to any customers who experience less than optimal performance on their new systems. And then there's some marketing drivel after that. So Macworld took a look at it, and they said their preliminary results from our 4K premiere test is that the 2017 2.9 gigahertz Core i7, 90 minutes to do this thing. The 2018 Core i9 before the patch, 80 minutes, so a delta of 10 minutes. The 2018 Core i9 after the patch is 72 minutes, which is 8 minutes quicker. So, and additionally, they also saw that the clock speeds were pretty flat, which indicated that things were operating as they should have been.
Yeah, because before the patch, the symptom was basically you'd have this, as I mentioned, the sawtooth graph of the, if you look at the processor frequency, where it would peak really high and then drop all the way down to 800 megahertz and then peak really high again and then drop all the way back down, and just like constant fluctuations, and something was clearly overheating or being mismanaged. Like, so that's not normal. It's not supposed to be that spiky and crazy. So the patch did indeed fix the problem. I actually talked to Apple about this. I had a call. I asked about the VRM thing. They said that was not it. But ultimately, I don't really have any more information than that isn't in the statement. I'm really, really curious to know just like some more technical detail about like a missing digital key in the thermal management system firmware. Like, I'm curious what that means.
You didn't ask Apple about it?
I did, but you know, I didn't get a lot of technical detail. You know, they were very, you know, friendly and open to whatever they knew how to answer. But unfortunately, you know, this statement really covers it all. Like, there's not, besides that I was able to confirm that the VRM thing was not it. I don't really have any other information that wasn't in the statement, but it was nice. I talked to them, you know, they seemed genuinely concerned. I asked them if they bought a freezer to rerun the YouTube test. They did not. They didn't seem to think that was very funny. So I would like to hear from any listeners who know about like just how this stuff works at this low level. What is that? A missing digital key? Does that just mean like whatever their method of controlling this in software, maybe like it was not running, or if it was not being loaded by some like firmware download at the CPU level, if the CPU was like falling back to its like built-in profiling instead of having Apple customize it, which I think might be what's going on. But I just want to know more about this at a low level, just out of curiosity's sake. But the reality is the problem is fixed in the sense that it is like, you know, before it had these weird thermal characteristics, and in many tests it was slower than the one that came before it, or was at least not faster by very much. And now the performance graphs have smoothed out and it is faster. It is, as what you'd expect, the fastest CPU option is the fastest performing in real world tests. So that, like, that was the real problem, and that problem seems to have been fixed. They did tell me that this problem affected all of the 2018 MacBook Pros. So not just the i9 and the 15-inch, but also the i7s and the 15-inch, and the 13-inch options as well. This bug apparently affected all of them, which does lend more credence to the fact that they are most likely telling the truth on the source. It isn't like some weird thermal thing with the i9 that it affects all of them. But I don't think people really saw it that much with 13 inches yet. So I don't know if we have a lot of test results to confirm like maybe how bad it was before and where it is now. But regardless, it's fixed. I'm happy. And it seems like it's pretty much a closed book.
I have the same academic curiosity about the explanation, because the fact like this one paragraph thing, it doesn't have technical details, but does decide to say a missing digital key, which is just enough to intrigue you. Say, really? Like,
right.
What does that even mean? Like, I mean, the theory that I've heard, you know, like you just said, the most prevailing one is it's, you know, some piece of software that's supposed to be signed and wasn't, and so didn't get loaded or something. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, they're not into giving you a technical explanation. But I think the most interesting part about this, again, it's not interesting to consumers. All you care is that the thing is fixed and it is so great, right? But that it's not actually like, It's one of those boring software problems where it's basically like a build system problem, or like a CI pipeline problem, or a packaging problem. Like, it's not actually a problem with the technology. It's a problem with the boring part of the system where you package up the bits for sale and make sure that those are the same exact bits that you tested. But of course you have internal only things. And so it was like what they were selling to consumers was not exactly the bits they thought they were. And it's great because you can fix a problem like this. It's not a hardware problem. It's like purely a software thing, and they can send you a software patch and it fixes it, right? This must be a relief to all the hardware people involved. Like everything's fine. The cooling system is fine. It's not a catastrophic failure of thermal paste or something. It's just the software we thought we were sending out to you on your laptop is not actually the software that you got. So here's a patch, and you know, everyone's relieved. It's kind of like how a lot of the recent leaks from Apple have been like similarly related to like the build system, or like putting things on URLs temporarily where they shouldn't be, or like just sort of mundane human error unrelated to the creation of the product. The people creating the product are working really hard and doing all the things and doing everything right as best they can. And then someone goes and accidentally puts like, you know, an unreleased version of operating system up on a public URL, or like the build system builds something that they think is an exact match for what they tested, but actually isn't. And they ship these laptops to people and they have the wrong bits on them. Stuff like that happens. Like, it's not a big deal. This is a pretty fast turnaround time, but I'm still technically curious about the details, and somebody's boring tell all nerd book about Apple 20 years from now can include this in a chapter.
This will be the most boring chapter.
And we're like, let me tell you about the time that the build system screwed up somehow.
We are sponsored this week by Linode. Go to linode.com/ATP to learn more and get a $20 credit. Linode is my favorite web host. If you need a virtual private server, not only is it the best VPS host I've ever used, and I've used a lot of hosts, it's the best web host I've ever used, period. Because now the VPSs are so fast now, they compete with dedicated, in my opinion. Like, I've used a lot of dedicated servers. VPSs, I think, are the way to go for almost anybody. And Linode is the place to do that because they have 24/7 friendly support. They have phone support if you need it. The performance is fantastic because you're running on native enterprise-grade SSDs. You're backed by a 40 gigabit network running on Intel Xeon E5 processors. So this is really high-spec stuff here. All that's for an amazing price. Their 1 gig plan is just $5 a month. They have all sorts of plans that go up from there, but depending on what your needs are, you can pick 10 data centers. You can put your server. All of this is backed by a 7-day money-back guarantee. So you can see for yourself, there's nothing to lose. The pricing is very, very fair. As I mentioned, they're great value. I think consistently the best value in the hosting business by far. And they back it up too with constant upgrades. Like, they just did an upgrade now. About every few months, they will do an upgrade where you just get more. Whatever plan you were paying for before, you can go click a button and you just get upgraded to a bigger server, and you just get even more resources for the same price you were paying before. I love Linode. And if you have a need for your own virtual private server, whether that is a web application like what I'm running on mine, you can run Docker containers, you can use encrypted disks, you can run VPNs. It is by far the nicest host I've ever used. I've been there the longest, and I think it's the best value in the business. So check it out today at linode.com/ATP. That will get you a $20 credit. And if you pick that 1 gig plan for just $5 a month, that could be 4 free months. That's pretty awesome. And once again, there's a 7-day money-back guarantee, so there's nothing to lose. Check it out once again, linode.com/ATP. Thank you so much to Linode for hosting all my stuff and supporting our show.
All right, and then we had one final piece of drama over the last few days that luckily this show has avoided. The Intel Power Gadget utility, which I guess is a way... I've not used this. Marco, have you used this?
I have, actually. Okay. It's Intel's kernel extension that you have to install. But basically, it becomes an app that you can run that simply shows you nice little graphs and numbers about what your processor is doing, how fast it's going, what kind of utilization it has, like as a percentage, and how much power it's drawing. So that's how we're able to see things like, oh, this CPU is spiking to this bit, you know, peak frequency, and then dropping, and then spiking again, and then dropping, and the wattage is going crazy, and the temperature is not, and like you can see all things like that because of this utility from Intel called the Intel Power Gadget. And as far as I know, I don't think there's another way to get... You can get like heat from various system settings reading apps, but I don't think you can get clock speed and CPU wattage that easily or that precisely from anything else.
Right. So this thing existed and then didn't and now does again. So apparently it was pulled from Intel's site right around the time everyone was trying to grab it to figure out what the hell was going on with these new MacBook Pros. And then... So, I guess was version 3 just appeared in the last 48 hours. that sort of does the same thing. One of you guys was kind enough to put a quote in the show notes. In version 3, there are additional features that include estimation of power on multi-socket systems, as well as externally callable APIs to extract power information within sections of code. And apparently it's important to note the latest release also includes support for Windows 10.
That's like the entire changelog. So the mystery, again, with the, you know, if you wanted to assume that Apple is evil, it's like, oh, they found this problem and their solution is to get on the phone and tell Intel to pull the power gadget. Like, but then it's back a day later or whatever. And when it comes back, the changes have nothing to do with, like, because it's not multi-socket system. It's not Windows 10. And it's not about instrumenting sections of code. Like, why did it disappear? And, you know, why did they then release version 3? Who knows? It could have been just a coincidence. But either way, all the people screaming that it was a conspiracy theory about some terrible problem Apple had, the problem Apple had was actually not terrible. It was actually easy to fix, and they fixed it immediately, and then the power gadget is back. So don't always assume that Apple is out to get you.
Well, but at the same time, like, you know, you could see why people got here, right? Because Apple's solution when the 2016 MacBook Pro came out and had weird, terrible battery life, depending on what you were doing, was to hide the battery life remaining indicator in the menu bar forever. Like, so, like, their solution there was, here's this thing that's showing people how weird our battery life is with these new complicated laptops. We're just going to hide that information. So it actually was totally plausible that Apple's solution to people are seeing weird things in the frequency graph might be convince your partner Intel to pull the frequency graph utility from your website. Like, that is a totally plausible outcome based on their past performance. So I can see why people thought that.
Don't you think hiding the number, though, is partly because the numbers weren't accurate and they were misleading? Like, the thing with the speed thing is, like, look, you can hide the power gadget or not let people install the power gadget all you want. They still have a stopwatch. They can still run a workload and time it versus the old version and say, I don't need to see what the frequency is. I don't know what the problem is. All I know is this thing is slower than it should be. Like, and that, you can't stop people from doing that. And, like, the battery power thing is, like, we have bad estimates of battery power, and people are flipping out about, because they're flipping out when they see the bad estimate. They never actually say, okay, is that actually how much time I have remaining? Start a stopwatch now. Like, they're just flipping out on the numbers. So, and, like, the fact that it was back like a day later, it just doesn't add up to me. And maybe they did, maybe some panic PR person did call and ask them to pull it. But I don't think it was part of some grand conspiracy to hide a big problem, because there wasn't a big problem. There just wasn't. Like, the problem was a small problem and it was fixed. And it was not unexpected. They didn't have to research it for a month. They didn't have to do extensive testing. I bet it was pretty quick when someone said, I figured out the problem. People don't have the right bits on their computer. Like, it's the best problem to have. Like, this is not actually a problem. It was the build system or whatever. I'm calling it the build system. That's probably the wrong word. I'm sure there's some Apple word for, like, the way things get onto the computers that you buy. I don't think you can. Yeah, I can see where people got there, because, again, people assume Apple is always evil or whatever, but just things happen so fast and were so quickly disproved in this case that I don't think people even had enough time to get up a full head of steam about being angry about the conspiracy theory about Apple making Intel pull its gadget and then re-add it with Windows 10 support. It could be like the sticky note on the store where it's like, this is just every time they update the power gadget utility, it's always gone for a day.
All right, so moving on, let's talk a little bit more about Intel. Because about a month ago, a friend of the show, Ben Thompson, wrote a really, really, really great article at Stratechery with regard to kind of Intel's problems and how they got in this, I guess, mess that they're in today. It's been a while since I've read this, although I certainly did read it. John, I think you might have added this to the show notes. Can you come take it away and tell us about this?
On this show, we've talked about Intel, I think, most of the time in the context of, like, ARM stuff, ARM Macs or Intel chips and phones, you know, just kind of the comparison between what Intel offers Apple and what Apple is essentially offering itself by, like, buying PA Semi and making its own chips and making its own GPUs and doing all of this stuff. And I think maybe a year or two ago, one of the focuses was that Intel had a big strategic advantage to Apple in that their process technology, meaning how small they can make the features on their chips, was a generation ahead of everybody else. And so no matter how much more efficient ARM CPUs were, no matter how much Apple could custom tailor them to their exact needs, it's very hard to overcome the fact that Apple had to make all of its ARM chips using larger feature sizes, bigger transistors, than Intel did. So even though Intel may have old and creaky chips, and x86 is old and creaky, even x86-64, and it's inefficient, and all these reasons why ARM is better than Intel, Intel has this advantage of, like, they take whatever their designs are, and they can make them much smaller than everyone else, and they use less power, and they just have all these advantages. And the discussion then was, wouldn't it be great if Apple could get its, like, its ARM CPUs or system on a chips or iPhone stuff and design them, you know, and but then have Intel make them. Say, we have the designs, Intel, we don't actually want your chips. We just want you to be a fab for us. Here's the design, you make it for us. And you make it on your industry leading, smaller than everybody else, always ahead by a year and a half, 2 years ahead of everybody else. And that would be the best of both worlds. It would be the best chip designs, and then the smallest fabrication size. And the discussion then was like, yeah, but why the hell would Intel do that? Because they can't charge you as much. They can charge you way more for their high-end, you know, Intel CPU, you know, Xeons or i9s or whatever, because it's like, that's our intellectual property. We design it and we fab the chip. And so we get, you know, we can double dip there. Whereas if we're just a dumb fab and we just say, oh, we'll manufacture things for you and you'll bring the thing yourself, we can't get as much money from you. So, and we're ahead of everybody else. So I bet everybody would love for us to fab their stupid designs, but we're only going to fab our designs. That's our competitive advantage. You all suck. Intel is great. And that seems like such a long time ago. Maybe it wasn't as long ago as I thought, but it seems like such a long time ago. And over in the time since then, there's been smaller stories about Intel willing to fab chips for other people, which I think that have appeared in our show notes at various times. And maybe we haven't actually talked about it. Maybe they just got booted out because the game became irrelevant. But the most recent story, as we've talked about on the past few shows, is Intel, its supposed cadence, it used to be the TikTok where it would be like they do an architecture change, then a shrink, then architecture change, then a shrink on a, like a yearly cadence or an 18-month cadence or whatever the hell it was, has been slowing down, and they made all these PR things. It used to be TikTok, and now it's like process optimized, whatever. Like they made a three-step process, and then as Marco said a few shows ago, now it's TikTok, talk, 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 talk. They've been stuck at 14 nanometers for a really long time, for longer than anyone thought they would be, including Intel. Intel had grand plans for their 10 nanometer thing. Now, about 6 months ago, we were hearing like TSMC, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation, they've made it to 10 nanometers or 7 nanometers or whatever. They're ahead of Intel. And then people were quick to say, well, again, kind of like base clock speed and TDP, feature size is another one of those things that used to have perhaps a more common and simpler definition than it does these days, because now people are making transistors with these strange 3D arrangements of elements at the microscopic level, like building these little, you know, pyramids and structures and fins, and like it's not as easy to say, well, what is your feature size? What are you measuring between? What is your, you know, it's like dot pitch on a monitor or versus dot pitch on a Trinitron. Like it's all kind of fuzzy. And the gist of it was that Intel's 10 nanometer is actually smaller than TSMC's 10 nanometer, or maybe even smaller than TSMC's 7 nanometer or whatever. And so there was, you know, maybe 6 months ago, still a reason to say, yeah, it looks like Intel might have lost its fab lead, but it's not actually true. But at this point, with Intel still unable to deliver 10 nanometer stuff, and TSMC making, I think they call their 7 nanometer or whatever, like, it doesn't matter that Intel's 10 nanometer, it may be as good as or better than a similar number from TSMC. TSMC looks like it's going to actually deliver its process in shipping products for customers, and Intel still can't. And so, I mean, Ben Thompson's article is more about the history of Intel and like how it got to this point. But I feel like Intel's strategy, aside from like selling their ARM holdings and losing and opting out of the contract to make the CPU for the original iPhone and various other strategic mistakes, if Intel was still ahead of everybody on process, their integrated design, as Ben calls it, where they make the CPUs and have the fab, would still be a viable strategy. But if you're not the best fab in the world, and when you were, you also refused to fab things for other people, all you're left with now is x86 and its legacy of compatibility, and a fab that is not helping you at all. I mean, what? At a certain point, it might be better for Intel to have TSMC manufacture their chips for them if they can never get 10 nanometers. Like it's just, they're in a bad situation. And it's one of those bad situations that's explicable. It's like, this stuff is very difficult to do. You make some bad bets 7 years ago or 5 years ago, whatever the crazy lead times are, and deciding how you're going to fab your 10 nanometer. And sometimes it just doesn't work out. Like, it's a bummer. It's a bummer for Intel, but it's an honest loss. Like, it, you know, it feels honest. It feels more honest to me than boneheaded decisions like, you know, sticking like Itanium, their instruction set that was going to compete with x86-64, and opting out of the iPhone and all that other stuff. And maybe also feels like a more honest loss than refusing to fab for other people, because I feel like there was a way because they were a leader, their fab was in the lead for so long, there should have been a way for them to leverage that to make money while also maintaining like their, you know, their top end deals. Like, we'll fab for certain other people, but we won't fab things to compete with their own chips. And I'm sure they did that to a limited degree, and that's what the stories were about a few months ago. But now they're in a really rough place where they need to get their 10 nanometer process online, because they can't just keep making new arrangements of the same cores in 14 nanometer forever. Eventually, if they get stuck like this for much longer, Apple will have no choice but to leave. It's kind of like the Power Mac G5 situation all over again, where they just, Apple just couldn't get better parts. They couldn't get laptop parts, period, and they couldn't get faster chips for their high end thing. So it's like, what choice do we have? We have to go to Intel, essentially, because the option would be, I guess we'll just keep shipping water-cooled Power Mac G5s forever at the same exact speed, because we have no one to buy a faster CPU from. And Intel said, we have faster CPUs, and we make them faster every year, and so you should come to us, and they did. Like, say Intel comes out with these 8-core i9s, right? What happens next year? 12-core i9s? Like, you eventually can't. Right. It becomes the size of a Kraft American cheese slice inside your computer. Like, you can't just keep adding cores, and there's not enough parallelism into workloads to deal with that anyway. I don't think they're in that situation. I think they probably will get their process online. Like, they're highly motivated to do so, but it's probably safe to say that Intel has lost the massive lead they used to have, and not that we're on board this sinking ship, because again, the ARM CPUs that we're imagining are theoretical. Like, hey, where is the ARM CPU to compete with the Xeon? Doesn't exist. It could, maybe it does inside Apple, but you can't say there's an obvious thing to go to. And of course, there's AMD, which is resurgent and which does not fab its own chips. It uses GlobalFoundries, which is the fab part of AMD that they spun off. And I think GlobalFoundries also might be catching up to / matching Intel in process at this point. I haven't been keeping up with them as much as TSMC. But yeah, the world order in the silicon and chip CPU world has really, really turned upside down from even just a few years ago. And we just, you know, we collectively as consumers and Apple are all kind of stuck having to make some very difficult decisions, which is like, our decision is, do I keep buying these new computers every year, even though they aren't getting that much faster or better, right? At a certain point, it's like, what's the point of me buying a new laptop if it's about the same as the one I bought last year? Or if my phone is faster, again, look at the Geekbench scores for the iPhone 10 and compare them to Apple's entire current MacBook and MacBook Pro line. You will be depressed. Right. And Apple's choice is, do we basically have to, should we have started a project to switch the Macs to ARM 3 years ago? And in retrospect, we only realize it now. And now we're kind of screwed, too, because it's not like we have alternatives. Do we start talking to AMD and see if they can make some kind of, you know, Ryzen technology laptop chips for us? Like, it's so much easier when you're like, we have the best CPUs, and every year Intel comes out with new ones, and we're on this great gravy train that lasted a long time. But it's, you know, the smooth ride is over, and some hard decisions are going to be coming soon, and it's not really anybody's fault. Like, except for maybe you could say Apple should have had more contingency plans, but yeah, things are about to get real interesting, it seems like.
We are sponsored this week by Backblaze, unlimited cloud backup for Macs and PCs for just $5 a month. Go to backblaze.com/ATP for a fully featured 15-day free trial. Backblaze is by far the best cloud backup. I've used a bunch of these services. Backblaze is the best one I've used. I've been with them the longest. I entrust them with my data. With Backblaze, you can access your data anywhere in the world, on the go, on your phone, on a laptop, on the web, whatever you want. You can even use it as not only just like disaster recovery, but even if you just forgot a file on your home computer, you can open up Backblaze while you're traveling or whatever on your phone, your laptop, and you can go pick that file and just download that file from Backblaze. So it's great even just for practical uses like that, not even including disaster recovery. And of course, if you have a disaster, cloud backup is what you want because it is out of your house or your apartment or your workplace. It is somewhere else off-site. So the disasters that affect your stuff can affect your backup as well. If you already have Backblaze at home, tell your sysadmin at work to go to backblaze.com/ATP also, because they can hit a business backup link over there on the top of that page. They offer the same awesome service with more admin tools using their Backblaze groups feature. Backblaze, all of this is just gimmick-free, $5 a month for unlimited full backups. You can plug in as many hard drives to that computer as you want for $5 a month, and they will back them up. You can see for yourself with a 15-day fully featured free trial at backblaze.com/ATP. Go there, play with it, start protecting yourself today. This is the kind of thing, like, it's like saving for retirement. Like, you want to start this yesterday. You don't want to be caught without this if it's too late. You want cloud backup, and if you're going to have cloud backup, Backblaze is the best. Go to backblaze.com/ATP for that 15-day free trial. Thank you so much to Backblaze for sponsoring our show.
Greg Kolodijic, he writes, do you ever use higher than default scaling on Retina screens? If so, when? So let me see if I can figure out the right way to summarize this. So since Retina is by default just kind of pixel doubling everything, so you have 2 pixels worth of information where one would have been before. That's a summary. I'm sure it's somehow technically inaccurate, but you get the idea. So what you can do is if you have good eyes, which I do not, then you can actually go in some laptops, you can go to the native resolution such that you can get everything to be really, really tiny and you can fit a whole bunch of stuff on your screen. So I have terrible eyes and I never do that. And in fact, I think on my, actually maybe on my adorable, I do now that I now I'll have to double check that. But on my old work laptop, which was a 15-inch laptop, I absolutely left it as the default. And that's because I have terrible eyes. John, you now have a laptop. What are you doing with this?
I do run mine at non-native res because I never look at that screen. And remember, my goal was to have my external monitor be exactly the same resolution as my internal monitor, because I mirror them, because then every time I connect my external monitor, none of my windows move. So that's what I do. My internal monitor, I run at a non-native 1920 by 1200, and I just never look at that screen. And that's exactly what my external monitor, 24-inch, runs at. And so, yeah, I don't like non-native res. When I have to take my laptop to the meeting and I have to look at the non-native res, it's too small for me, and B, it's blurry. So it's not what I prefer, but I do it at work for that particular reason.
So it is worth pointing out that the default scaling has changed. The 2016s, you know, didn't actually change the number of pixels or the size of the screens, but they did change the default to be one notch higher than native. Rather than saying do you use higher than default scaling, what we really should be doing is do you use higher than native 2x scaling, which by default with the new ones you do. So on the 15-inch, that would be if you use the one that simulates 1680 instead of 1440, that would be one notch up. That is the current default, but the actual native pixels are 1440 times two. I use the 1440 setting most of the time on my 15-inch because even though things are kind of big and kind of chunky, I like that. Like, I like the scale that it's at. When I'm doing like work, like heavy work, like Xcode or Logic, I will bump it up. I use a utility called iFriendly that's EYE, not I, you know, the letter. So iFriendly is, I've mentioned it before, it's a utility where you can just assign like a certain combination of modifier keys and then the up and down arrows to next resolution to up or next resolution down. So you can change resolutions really quickly just with a key command. And so I will use that to oscillate between the super high one that John uses, the 1920 simulated one, if I'm doing podcast editing in Logic, or the 1680 one, which is the one step above default, or one step above native, which is the new default. I'll use that one doing coding, Xcode, stuff like that. Or if I'm just doing like email and Twitter and wasting time like that, I will use the 1440, which is the native 2x mode, where everything's a little bit bigger.
Real-time follow-up on my Adorable. I actually do have it set to more space. So the default is 1280 by 800. I have it set to 1440 by 900. I guess my eyes aren't as bad as I thought. Go me.
An actual 2x pixels on that or something like that. It's like the 1152 whatever by whatever. That's the actual 2x pixels on that screen.
Yeah, 1152 by 720.
Your eyes are bad though, Casey, because you couldn't tell it was non-native.
Yeah, it's real blurry. I hope so badly that when they do a major redesign of these laptops, I really want to see the 2x pixel, actual pixel nativeness move up one step. Like, I want the 15 inch to actually have, you know, 1680 times two. I want, and you know, similar, like I want the 13 inch to have 1440 times two. Like, I want them to actually move up a step in pixels to match their current space setting defaults.
Do they ever do that on the Plus phones?
Oh, that's a good question.
The Plus phones are still using their like 3x scaling down to a 1080p screen, but the iPhone X actually has those 3x pixels.
Yeah, that's kind of a shame about the Plus. I was hoping that eventually there was like a stopgap and eventually they would just do native, but I guess they did, but just on the 10. So maybe when they're all 10-ish phones, will we finally be done with that non-native. Not that it's bad. It looks fine in the Pluses, but it bothers me at like a anal retentive level.
And honestly, I think like on the 15-inch, you know, when you run it at the one step above at the 1680 step, I think it looks okay. I can usually stop noticing it after a little while. But when I spent that, you know, day owning the 12-inch, I never stopped noticing that the screen just looked kind of blurry and crappy. Like, I think the smaller the screen is, the more apparent that difference is. And the 12-inch, I think, looks noticeably bad in that way.
I am glad I cannot see it.
Yeah.
James asks, what tech-related opinions that you once strongly held do you now cringe about? For example, saying something like the original iPhone size was the optimum size, which I think I might have said.
Me too.
And the bigger Android phones were ridiculous, which I think I also said.
Me too.
What other opinions did you have that maybe you were wrong about? And I was thinking about this earlier today, and it occurred to me that not only do I have a great opinion to share with everyone, but I have documentation to prove it. So when I was big into Tumblr back in like 2008, and I at the time was running Ubuntu on a ThinkPad, and I did a distro upgrade from like Gutsy Gibbon to Hardy Heron or something like that. I forget exactly which one it was, but everything crapped the bed, and I decided I'm over it. And meanwhile, I was going back and forth with one Marco Arment via Tumblr discussing why do you like Macs? Like, it's just you're paying for the name, you're paying for the design, whatever that means. Like, they're just a big waste of money. I can build something much cheaper. And you and I, Marco, basically had this back and forth over the course of like a month over Tumblr, like quote tweet, or not quote tweets, good grief, Tumblr reblogs and things of that nature. And it is all there for you to see, my friends. If you go to the URL in the show notes, you can laugh at how ignorant and silly I was back in the day. And that is something that I probably shouldn't put in the show notes because I'm pretty embarrassed by it. But you know what? It's part of me. And that was me 10 years ago. So, Marco, what do you regret having said?
I mean, a lot. Like, I regret most of what I said, like, by the next day, let alone, like, if I look at, like, my old blog posts. I mean, you're really playing on hard mode here, Casey. Like, looking at your own blog posts, like, yeah, everyone's old blog posts are embarrassing to them. They should be. If they're not.
Luckily, yours are dead links. Tumblog, which is not a word, .marco.org/post/big number is 404. Or actually, the host name doesn't even resolve.
And actually, speaking of that, I found a link on one of my posts to an old Marco.org post, like the old Marco.org.
Oh, those are
where
rough.
It was just Marco.org/number, and those are very broken as well.
They're very rough. The links are still up. Maybe some redirects are broken, but like those pages are still up somewhere. Oh God, they're bad. Please don't find them. Like, there's one where like it was like right after the iPhone was announced, and I'm like, I'll care later about the iPhone. It's actually called like the iPhone I Will Care Later, and it's like, yeah, it's expensive. I just got this awesome new, you know, Sprint Motorola Q. I don't need the iPhone. Yeah, that lasted like 3 months, but yeah, it's, I mean, I've always been an idiot with this stuff, so like a lot of what I say I look back on very poorly. If I can try to pick out some major themes, I think one major theme is that I still view phones as these like secondary and inferior devices, but a whole lot of people out there view phones as their primary device. And I still need to get a little bit more on board with that. Also, I think kind of a major theme of my mistakes and misstatements and regretted opinions is something that I think is pretty common here. Judging new tech primarily by its specs or its pricing. And this is kind of like what you were saying a second ago, Casey, about like when you were judging Macs, like before you saw the light. Like it's so common for people like us to react to something, some new device or tech or announcement or whatever, as like, oh, you can, like, you know, the iPad or the iPod has, you know, less space than a Nomad, lame. Like there's like, it's, you know, to judge tech based on like, oh, that's a terrible deal. I can build a cheaper machine than that. You know, why does anybody buy this thing or whatever? And kind of a larger theme of that is like, you know, understanding the reasons why things can be good or compelling, or the reasons why people might choose to buy something, go beyond specs and pricing. You know, there are lots of other factors. There are lots of utility factors that we might not know about that aren't just raw specs. There are, you know, pricing things that, like, you know, the price might matter a lot more to somebody than somebody else, or, you know, whether it's like, you know, people at different income levels, or whether it's like, you know, a business buying something versus a person buying something, or, you know, the value something might have to somebody might be very different depending on who they are, what their needs are. And even things like underestimating fashion and visual appeal of things. Like, one of the big reasons why the 12-inch MacBook has been pretty well selling, as far as I can tell, is that it's cute. It's really cool. Like, it's just like it really does hit that fashion and visual appeal thing, in addition to, you know, the practical nature of having something very small. Like, there's a reason why people buy this incredibly compromised machine. And it's not because it's incredibly compromised. It's because, like, there is some practical aspect to it being so small and light, but also it's really cute and a lot of people like that and it just looks cool. And then finally, to kind of close this out, just generally, the biggest ways I get things wrong are assuming that whatever the important factors are in evaluating things like this today will be equally important tomorrow. That basically, assuming that the factors that matter won't shift over time, when in fact, if you look at what happens in tech, they always shift over time. Like, everything is constantly shifting. We are standing on quicksand. Like, everything is constantly moving around. But I too often assume that whatever the situation is now, it'll just be that way indefinitely. And that's far from true.
John?
It's a burden being on the right side of tech history so much, because while you two were toiling in the PC mines, I was trying to tell anyone who listened that GUIs were the future, that mice were awesome.
This is like the best statement ever on the show.
I was trying to think of an opinion like that I would cringe about. So part of it is, yeah,
and you've thought of none.
I've been an Apple fan from the start, so
my opinion is that it's so hard being right all the time.
Well, no, but like if you're an Apple fan from the start, you had to endure like a decade of everyone telling you you were nuts and that you knew nothing about technology and that only toy computers had mice and the GUI was stupid, right? And there was, you know, it wasn't actually that long, but it seemed like a long time, and it seemed like everyone else said that and you were in this, but we were eventually proven right. Cringeworthy opinions, like, I was thinking about how much I preferred essentially 72 DPI black and white screen, like on the original Mac. Like, the pixels could be black or white. There was no gray, like, to be clear to the people listening who don't remember this. That was it, black or white. But the pixels were really, really small. Like, they were essentially 72 DPI, like 1x, what we would consider 1x in today's retina parlance, not 2x retina, but 1x, like the, you know, half of that resolution. And I preferred that to CGA 320 by 200 with pixels the size of boulders, even though they had color, right? Or whatever, it was CGA, 8 color, 16 color? 8 color, I think, maybe. 8 ugly colors. You would think, well, okay, well, later you'll look back on that and say, how could you have preferred black and white? But I look back on it and say, I still think that was, you know, for my taste, my personal taste, that's what I preferred. And I don't regret it and saying, oh, you were just saying that because your computer couldn't have color, because there was no option for color on the original Macs until the Mac 2, right? Which I didn't have, even when it came out. Was it motivated by just the things I can't have? But I look back on it now, you know, many, many years distant, and say, I kind of do prefer the precision of the monochrome screen than having 8 very ugly colors in CGA with like whatever rectangular pixels or whatever. I still hold that opinion. And that gets to the heart of this whole cringe about now. I don't regret having opinions that were based on the best information available at the time, right? Like that, you know, I couldn't have been expected to know the future. And so I don't, you know, don't regret, like, I mean, maybe you could say it's a lack of foresight or whatever, but it's difficult for me to think of, you know, big phones are a good example. I still don't like big phones. And you could say, well, you know, I never made a proclamation that the world won't like them or that no one should have one, right? But I made a proclamation that I don't like them, and I still don't like them. They're just not for me, right? If I had made a proclamation that Apple should never make a big phone because no one will ever buy them, I would cringe about that, but I don't think I ever did that. Like I'm so retentive about this. Maybe it comes from writing all those articles and getting all people yelling at me about them early on, but it's like, I'm pretty careful in what I say to be measured. It may not be what people hear, but it's definitely what I always wrote, because my greatest joy in the world was quoting myself back to people, because they would say, you said the blah, blah, blah. And I just copy and paste from the article in the comment section and say, here's the sentence that I wrote. And they would say, but that sentence says whatever. And then I would paste the same sentence and I put a word in bold. I'd be like, reading comprehension, people. Right there. It's not what I try to be precise, and podcast is obviously harder to be precise. But in general, I feel like I've been mostly measured with things. The best I came up with, and I think it's a pretty good one, although still I feel like it falls under the category of best information available at the time. I don't think it's cringeworthy, but it's probably my worst call ever. It was a call. It wasn't like a strongly held opinion, but this thing was stated as like, you know, what strongly held. This wasn't a strongly held opinion. This is more like a one-off, which is perhaps just as damning or whatever. But I feel like it was something, an opinion, a prediction based on the best information available at the time. And it was back before, you know, like Steve Jobs had, I think they had bought Next or whatever, right? Apple had bought Next, right? And Steve Jobs is not really back. He's like, you know, I don't think he was even CEO, interim CEO at that point or whatever. It was like, so what's the deal? So Apple got Next, you know, they were looking at B, they got Next. Next is cool. B was cool. They went with Next. And hey, you get Steve Jobs back. Isn't that great too? And the reason I remember this one is because I wrote it and people like quote it back to me occasionally. And it was like, I was not optimistic about the chances of Steve Jobs coming back at Apple. I was like, I give him a few years and he'll burn out, because he's such a loser. He's such a burnout. He burned out of Apple, right? Because he did the Mac and then just got ousted and just was a big baby about it and started Next. And that company basically failed to do anything that they wanted it to do and just got acquired by Apple. And so, yeah, you got Next and it's a cool operating system. You got some great technology and you got Steve Jobs. But what are you expecting Steve Jobs to do for you? He's a two-time loser, right? Like he's not cut out to lead this company. And so I had like a one-off line in one of my articles. So it was like, yeah, Steve Jobs is back, but I'm not sure how great he'll do. I'll give him a few years, right? And based on Steve Jobs' entire history as, you know, an entrepreneur and a manager of corporations and as a CEO up to that point, that was to save money, right? It was the wrong call, obviously, and perhaps the wrongest call ever to be wrong, but it was based on the best information available at the time. It's not like I was ignorant of Steve Jobs' history. I'd read everything about him. I'd been following his entire career. He was like my idol, right? I loved the Mac. I love everything about it. But as a great person to lead a company in the right direction, he had not proven to be that at all, right? So that's probably my worst call. And I don't cringe about it too much, but it's just so incredibly fantastically wrong. And again, just a one-liner, a throw article. But all the my other tech opinions, I feel like mostly are founded on reasonable conclusions based on the information available. I'm going to throw this to you too, because maybe I'm just terrible at remembering places where I made a terrible call. Is any that you can recall in the history of ATP or even before that you want to remind me of that I'm forgetting?
Bazell. Moving on. Ian Bradbury writes...
It's a strongly held opinion.
Come on, don't ruin my joke.
That's all you got? You got nothing?
I honestly don't know. I mean...
Remember when John thought that one-star reviews are only left by old people or by young people? What was it? Like, you were totally wrong. Like, it was so comically wrong.
I think that was a case where I was more precise than you thought I was.
Oh, my
Yeah, okay.
That was what the that's what the subsequent debate was about the precision, about what you heard versus what I said. But anyway, mm-hmm. we already had that debate, and that's not a cringeworthy thing, and we didn't have any good information in one direction or the other, so it was inconclusive.
Mm.
I mean, honestly, I can't think of anything that you've said that has been just unequivocally wrong, and I'm sure there have been things said, but
that's factual errors. But this is a strongly held opinion. Like,
No, I remember, like, you were saying, like, that negative reviews and badly written reviews were all young people. That, like, old people would never do that. That's
I'm
what
sure
you were
I said.
Arguing.
I'm sure I said all young people. I'm sure I said never.
Yep, that was you.
You know, I'm always going with the absolutes.
That sounds like you.
Moving on before we all divorce each other. Ian Bradbury writes, can we get an update on your crash plan situation? Wait. Who rearranged this? This was done on purpose. See, I'm
I
just
put the
a
most
monkey.
Frivolous one at the end.
But there was a reason it was in that order, John. You're messing with my system.
I always put the most frivolous at the end.
Well, but there was a purpose for this, but that's okay.
This purpose is not discernible to me, so feel free to rearrange.
Is this one of your biggest regrets?
All right, now we just got to reboot this whole darn thing because, well, we'll just see how this turns out. Okay, here we go. Where's the little clapper? Take two, clap. James Evans writes, there are too many recipes online and I'm clueless. Would Syracuse share the secrets of his favorite pasta sauce?
I think I've talked about this on other shows. No, I don't. I don't put the recipe of my family's pasta sauce recipe. It's boring. Like, most people wouldn't like it. It's not exciting. It doesn't have anything interesting. There's no secret ingredient. It is not novel. It doesn't taste any different than anything you've seen. It's very straightforward. And so I say no reason to put it up, because if I put it up, it'll be like an endorsement. You should try this recipe. You'll love it. You probably won't love it. It'll probably just be like, why would I ever do this? It's like, I'd rather have it out of a jar because that's what you want. But it's the pasta recipe that I want, and it's the pasta recipe that I feed my family, and that's fine with me. I feel no reason to share my incredibly boring family pasta recipe with anybody.
Knowing full well that you would say something along those lines, I have a bonus question. Ian Bradbury writes,
"That's the most BS answer ever." Like,
but it's true. I don't want the burden of people saying, "Hey, I tried your recipe, I didn't like it." Good, fine, whatever. You know, like, It's not worth. You're not missing anything. Go find any recipe online, try it, find the one you like, go with that one.
What should sauce absolutely have in it, and what should sauce absolutely not have in it?
We're talking about tomato sauce. It should probably have tomatoes.
Okay.
I'm going to say that. I feel like a safe bet, tomato sauce should have tomatoes.
Fresh, crushed, cubed, diced?
Not diced. What do you mean?
Like, canned, I assume?
You can do it with I've done it with fresh, I've done it with canned. I think fresh is probably better, but it's really difficult. It has to be just the right tomatoes at just the right time. We grew them ourselves in our backyard for a little while, and even then it was like depending on like the crop and like when you pick them and what you got, like it was variable. Canned is much more reliable, and that's what we use all the time. So either way, what should not go in it? Like, tons of stuff.
Wait, hold on. Before you leave, so what kind of tomato? Are we talking like fancy, like San Marzano kind of thing? Like, yep, is there a certain kind that you like? Is there a certain brand? Because there's a brand that's called San Marzano, but they aren't actually San Marzano tomatoes.
Yeah, like, I think we talked about this with the olive oil thing. Like, olive oil and San Marzano tomatoes, it's very difficult to know whether you're getting the authentic article. I don't have any secret techniques for doing so. We just try to get legit San Marzano ones because we feel like there is a small difference in taste that makes it. But your mileage may vary. Maybe you like ones from New Jersey better. Maybe you like some from California better. I think it's personal preference, but there are good ones and bad ones, so try different ones.
Are there any other tomato products that you mix in with the canned tomatoes, like adding additional tomato paste or something like that?
Nope. You can do that. We do that with bolognese and stuff, but that's not our recipe. That's just from a book. But no, our family recipe does not add any tomato paste or anything. But I wouldn't, you know, if it's part of the recipe that you like, go for it, whatever.
Garlic, onions, both?
Both in mine, yeah.
Some people add sugar to sauce. Are you one of those, or do you have an opinion about that?
I am not one of those. I know people do that. If that's what you like, whatever. Like, I don't do it.
Do you cook the meat in the sauce with the sauce, or do you cook them separately and like apply the sauce to the meat like tableside?
So this is an interesting thing. So the recipe that we use is basically my father's mother's recipe, slightly modified. But my mother's mother also had a recipe. My mother's mother baked the meatballs in the oven, did not cook them in the sauce. My father's mother fried them in a pan and then let them cook the rest of the way through in the sauce. And so that's what we do. We form them, fry them in a pan to brown the outside, and then they cook the rest of the way in the sauce.
That seems like the most common.
But I've had my mother's mother did the baked ones, and I like those too. And her sauce was a little bit different as well. I can picture in my mind her sauce and my other, because I had both of them all the time. You go over one grandparent's house, you have one sauce. You go over the other grandparent's house, you have the other sauce. I prefer the one that we have now, but I like both of them.
Do you prefer a sauce with a prominent note of oregano or other spices like that? Or do you prefer it more just to be like, you know, tomato, garlic kind of thing?
Oregano for me brings to mind, I like oregano. I like tons of oregano. I put tons of oregano on my pizza. So oregano, a prominent oregano flavor in pasta sauce makes me think of pizza sauce. So I tend not to go in that direction, but lots of fresh herbs, you know, parsley, basil, stuff like that. I like that to be a flavor in the sauce, and it is a big component of my sauce, but not so much on the oregano. Cause like I said, I love oregano. I put way too much oregano on my pizza. My family hates it, but I love oregano, but it makes me think pizza, and that's not where I want to go.
If you were forced, you know, if you were somehow compelled in a way that you couldn't just weasel out of to have a jarred sauce, so if for some reason you're desperate, you need tomato sauce, you have to buy one of the jarred ones that would be in a typical grocery store, what do you buy?
That would never happen. I would not.
I know. I don't care. Just you're forced somehow. You're forced.
I don't know. I don't even know what brands are or what are available. I would not eat it. I would not buy it. I wouldn't. I just wouldn't.
Like,
do
when's
it.
The last time you have even had canned sauce?
My wife bought jarred sauce that she used in like one of her family recipes. Like it wasn't just on pasta. It was like some family recipe she had that one of the ingredients was like a jarred sauce. Probably the last time I had it is in whatever that recipe was, which I don't think we've made in years. I don't think I've ever had, other than like being a guest over someone's house when I was a kid, jarred sauce on pasta, like in my own home under my own control.
Wow.
What would you say to that question? What do you have a preferred sauce, jarred sauce?
I'd go Rao's. There's a lot of decent sauces these
Rao?
Days.
Rao? I've not heard of this.
Rao. It's common now. It's a little expensive. Like one of the big jars might often be like $8 if it isn't on sale. But it's really good. Their vodka sauce is also fantastic.
It's really easy to make sauce though, and it's really easy to make a huge amount of it for not a lot of money and freeze it. There's no reason anyone should have jarred sauce. Don't do it.
So was there anything else that people should absolutely not put in their sauce?
I mean, there's a million things. Don't put a whole turkey in it. Don't put donuts in it. I mean, like, what kind of question is this?
Thanks. Like, you have fulfilled all of my expectations for this question.
you kept going that what should absolutely not go in it? Like, I don't know, your cat. Like, it's come on. Like, wow. Is there some specific thing you're trying to get at? Like, you tried to ask the sugar thing. I don't think there's anything like anything commonly used that's particularly controversial. That like. You can come up with ridiculous stuff, but there's no commonly used ingredient that I'm going to say you should definitely not do. I mean, sugar is the closest because I feel like you probably shouldn't do that, but some people do, so whatever.
Are we done? Or do you want to do the last question?
Let's do the bonus question since it'll hopefully be quick. Although now my whole joke is ruined because I put this question in expecting John to not say anything about his sauce. And I'm actually kind of proud of you, Marco, because you were able to tease out some facts despite all that. So
made with tomatoes, basil, and oregano and onions and garlic. You've cracked it. You've cracked the code.
Hey, it's more than you were willing to share just a few minutes
boring.
Ago.
It's boring. I told you, like, in just all those in reasonable proportions and you're fine.
Anyway, Ian Bradbury writes, can we get an update on your crash plan situation?
How do we come back from that?
We don't have to cut it. This is why you have an edit.
No, go for it. Go for it. We're talking about crash plan.
Yeah, let's talk about crash plan.
By the way, we're sponsored this week by Backblaze. Go ahead.
Can we get an update on your crash plan situation? Are you still using them or have you bailed? I am still using them on the small business account for reasons, and most of them are laziness. John, what are you doing?
I'm still using it, and I think I got upgraded to the non-Java client. It's weird that I can't actually tell because it doesn't, like, I don't know. I don't think that the non-Java client, if that's what I indeed have, is any better or worse than the other one. Maybe I just have too much RAM on my Mac and I don't notice it. It's a little bit weird that I can't seem to get the menu bar thing to stay in the menu bar. Like, I can't, you know, the menu bar icon for CrashPlan. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not there a lot of the time, and I'm like, does that mean it's not backing up? But then I launch the app, and then I tell it to put the menu bar thing in, and it's like, oh, my last backup was like 10 minutes ago. So it's working, and it's doing its thing, and I can confirm that the backups are there, but it seems a little bit weird and flaky. Anyway, I'm still using it. I think it's still backing up my external volumes. Again, sometimes it seems like it's not. It's like, wait, it's unchecked. It's not backing up my external volume. But then I go look for a file that I put on my external volume like a week ago, and it's in the backup. So It's a little bit weird and flaky, but the price is still right, and it's still doing it.
Why? Okay, we're sponsored this week by Backblaze, and I like them a lot better than CrashPlan. That aside, like, why in God's name would you want your backup program, your like last line of defense, to be a little bit flaky and to not be entirely sure it's working?
That's not my last line of defense. You know how many lines of defense I have. That's like one of many lines of defense. There's no other thing that will do my backup drive without me doing iSCSI or something. And the drive I'm backing up, to be clear, is my media drive, which really I don't care that much about. Like, it's mostly just stuff I rip from disk. Like, so it's not. There is no essential data that I'm questioning. Like, I'm not sure if it got backed up or anything. It's just that I have no other way to back this up for such a low price, and CrashPlan continues to do it, so I let it. That's mostly just for convenience, so that if I do lose everything, I can get all my media back from my backup without having to, you know, worry about rebuilding that whole thing. But if I lose my media because it didn't back up or something, like, I don't care. It's just, you know, movies and stuff.
Thanks to our sponsors this week, Aftershocks, Backblaze, and Linode. And we'll see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin, 'cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him, 'cause it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRACUSA, Syracuse. It's accidental.
And my media is also duplicated to a second Synology that's sitting right next to it. So it's not like it's just on one.
Wait. Wait, time out.
I have a lot of backups.
Oh my God.
Which two Synologies do you have? You have a Play.
I have a Play, whatever, Play number, something. Yeah. Thing.
So I think it's 214, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think it's like a 2 drive or a 3 drive or something. Yeah,
you don't have enough media to long over. Like, I have enough junk.
But my giant Synology with 8 bays, only 2 or 3 drives are dedicated to media. And those 2 or 3 drives are duplicated to the second Synology.
Huh.
And it's also, I believe it's also, they're both also in some kind of RAID arrangement with redundancy.
Oh my God.
I have a lot of backups. Like, the chances of, and that's for my media that I don't even care about. It's just ripped movies and stuff. Like, it's not even I care about. The data that I care about is backed up like 1,000 times. So I think I'm good.
When you make the meat in the sauce, are you talking just, is it just meatballs? And we'll get to meatballs in a second. Or is it meatballs and sausage? And if it includes sausage, do you get sweet sausage, hot sausage, or a mix of both?
For most of my childhood, it was just meatballs. But when I would go over to my mother's house, she would do sausage too, and I like that. So in my own life, we have in recent decades gone to both, because my wife really likes the sausage, so we do sausage and meatballs, mostly meatballs, but with a little bit of additional sausage. I go with sweet sausage.
No hot at all.
That's no hot at all. It's just that's what I prefer. I think it works better for me.
I would argue you're missing out. I prefer a 50-50 split, but I
like it. It's fine, but it's not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for something that tastes like what I remember. And when I was a kid, my grandmother always did sweet sausage. So that's what I like.
Now, the meatballs.
Mm-hmm.
Similar to before, what definitely goes into the meatballs and what definitely does not, that some people might frequently put in?
Did either one of you ever have my pasta sauce and meatballs? And I feed it to you when you were over here, maybe?
I did. They were delicious, but I forgot about what's in them. So because that was a long time ago.
Let me just add my rule of meatballs for me. But like, I feel like it's applicable to other people, like, and it's not related to making them at home. It's that of all the things that you can order in an Italian restaurant, the one that someone like me most often avoids, and I would argue most people should avoid, is meatballs. I have never had a meatball at a restaurant in my entire life that was to my liking. It's not because they were bad. They were just different than what I wanted. Usually because they were fancier or weirder, or they're trying, like, but the variability of meatballs in restaurants is astounding. It is way bigger than the variability of like any other thing I can think of. You never know what you're going to get. Meatball could mean anything. You have no idea what the predominant taste is going to be, what the size is going to be, the consistency is going to be. You know nothing about it. It is totally a black box. And if you like just rolling the dice and it's fun, you know, to do or whatever, like I feel like Swedish meatballs have more consistency in restaurants than Italian meatballs. Because Swedish meatballs, they taste like Swedish meatballs. Italian meatballs, you have no idea what you're getting. So that's just my tip for meatballs. My meatballs are boring. They are beef only and, you know, and like breadcrumbs and you know, parsley and like all, just like it's not, that's it. No pork.
Do you use an egg to bind it?
Yeah.
Okay, so you got ground beef, you got an egg, parsley, breadcrumbs.
Salt and pepper,
yeah. Okay.
Like, they're very boring. Like, that's the problem. The reason I'll never go in at a restaurant is if you serve this at a restaurant, they'll be like, those meatballs are kind of bland. That's my meatball. Sorry. That's why, you know, that's it. They are very boring. No, I've made the fancier ones at home just to see if, like, I'm missing out on anything. Like, the whole, you know, bread soaked in milk. And so you ever do that whole big thing? Like
that? Yeah. I mean, I don't, Tiff is our meatballer in the family and she's very good at it, but she doesn't do that, I don't think.
And I've done it, and those are fine. It's just not what I'm personally looking for in a meatball. Like, I like them. I'll eat them. And sometimes, you know, other people have ordered meatballs in restaurants. And occasionally I've had one. And I'm like, oh, that's a pretty good meatball, but it's not what I want. Mine are boring. They are what I want. It has taken me 20 years of marriage to get my wife, who is the meatballer. She's the former of the meatballs in our chain, right? I'm the cooker of them. She's the former. To form them at the expected size, because I have a specific size that I want them to be.
See, and I wanna, no. That was going to be my next question. So, like, is it like, you know, golf ball size, like, or, you know, bigger, smaller?
She's got it down to a weight. She uses a food scale now. She's hacked the system.
Like, all right, what's the weight?
I don't know what the weight is. I can do it by eye, right? But she's the one who forms them, so she uses the food scale. And if she was here, she would tell me the exact weight. Maybe it'll be follow up in next week. It is bigger than a golf ball. It is smaller than a tennis ball.
Yeah, that seems about right. Because like one of the ways that restaurants often go wrong is by making them really big. No, like a lot of restaurants, you'll get like
the giant one, the American, like,
yeah, like, yeah, like baseball sized ones, right? And
yeah, that's like a meatloaf. It's like a bad meatloaf.
Yeah, like, because there's no good way to cook that. Like something that's that big.
Yeah, you have to bake it, or you have to leave it in the sauce forever.
Yeah, like it's never going to cook enough without overcooking the outside, or you'll just, you know, cook it forever and kill it. Like, and it'll just taste like nothing. Like there's no good way to do that.
I see more often in restaurants the tiny ones, like golf ball or smaller. That's too small.
Those are, I think, I have found those are usually frozen. Like I bet those are usually brought in, because like when you buy a big bag of like bulk meatballs at Costco, or if you,
which you should also not do not buy bags of meatballs, please.
Oh, those Costco meatballs are good.
Oh, come on.
Of course you think they're good.
Meatballs are so easy to make. You take meat, you put it in a ball. Like it could not be easier.
I'm pretty sure it's the Costco ones that I have realized over the last year or so are friggin' delicious. I love those things. I'll have to look and see what we have.
I feel like if you have meatballs for some not very important purpose, like if you're making a meatball sub, I love a good meatball sub. But honestly, the quality of the meatballs on a meatball sub is not as important as the quality of meatballs if you're having like pasta and meatballs as your entree.
If anything, you want the meatballs on a meatball sub to be like the crappiest meatballs they could possibly be, because it's like crappy fast food. Like it's you know. It's like wanting processed American cheese on your grilled cheese, because that's what a grilled cheese is supposed to be.
Right, or like a cheesesteak with Cheese Whiz, because like that actually,
yeah, everyone's got their line.
No, like I've been converted on this over time. Like I used to be solidly provolone on the cheesesteak, mm-hmm, but I tried, you know, with a couple trips to Philly in the last few years, I finally tried Cheese Whiz, and I had to admit, like I even did Tiff and I, like I got a provolone one, she got a Cheese Whiz one, and we each traded half of the other so that we could each have half of one, half of the other. It was unanimous. We both agreed, yeah, the provolone's good, but the Cheese Whiz was definitely better.
Well, we learned about both yours and Tiff's junk food tendencies from Top Four, so that kind of fits with my new culinary vision of your both of your palates.
Real-time follow-up with regard to the meatballs. Little Birdie has told me that the correct weight is 3.5 ounces.
All right. Thank you, Little Birdie. So I'm curious, you mentioned, you know, what goes into it, breadcrumbs, an egg and everything. I don't remember hearing you mention onion. Do you not put onion in meatballs? And if not, why?
I do not.
Why?
I don't know why. It's because my parents didn't, right? That's literally why. Like, I'm not making this. Again, I want to make them. We had pasta and meatballs every week of my life, essentially. Like, not on the same day every day, but pretty much once a week for my entire life until I left home, right? So it was a staple. And a staple like that, like, I liked it. It was good. It was one of my favorite meals. I want to keep having that meal. Why do I not put onions in it? Because they weren't in when I was a kid, and neither one of my grandparents put onions in it. That's why I don't do it. I'm sure it would taste good, and it would be fine. It would change it. It would make them a lot more moist, and that's not what my meatballs are like, so that's not what I do.
Are there any ways in which you deviate from your parents' recipe on this traditional meal?
Yeah, like the sausage is like combining, because my father's mother didn't do that. We put that in. The recipe I got from my dad, because he was the one who always made sauce at home. Like, you know, my wife can tell you by iMessage Casey. Like, the amounts that he wrote down seemed to be like off. And we, like, mess with them a little bit because they don't seem to be right. And what we need to do is write down a more accurate recipe for our children. At this point, like, I don't even know. Because my wife's the mixer of ingredients, right? So she's the one measuring out all the stuff and dumping it into the big thing. And she's the one mixing up the meatballs and forming them into balls, right? Following the recipe, supposedly, quote-unquote, following from what my dad wrote in our cookbook, like, when it was like, you know, take this cookbook out with you to be an independent adult. But he didn't write down. Like, what we do is not what he wrote down. So we really need to nail this down in some reproducible way. Now we just do it out of habit. It's like, this is just a thing we do. And it's just like an assembly line, and it just happens. But we have honed it a little bit to the point where when my dad visits and he makes his, quote unquote, his sauce, he doesn't make it as good as ours. So we must have done something to change it. Maybe we, maybe we're changing the ratio of, like, it could just be as simple as like salt and pepper, or like using pre-seasoned breadcrumbs versus not pre-seasoned. But anyway, what we make is now what I like. And I think it's actually has drifted from what I had when I was a kid, but it matches, like, because it's been a continuous, gradual thing, like, it matches my memory of what it should be.
Like, basically. Your accent.
Kind of. Like, yeah, it changes over time. But I honestly think we've improved it. I think I would rather make my sauce for myself than have anyone else make it.
Well, that's good. Like, that's kind of how you want it to be, right?
Because if you're not doing that, then, like, if you have some recipe that's like, oh, but I can never make it like my mom makes it, figure out how your mom makes it, right? Like,
or figure out a better way to do it that you end up like, because, like, you know, don't assume that, like, the way that your family's done it forever is the best it can be. Like, find your own path.
Yeah, that's kind of why we did it with fresh, because my parents, to my knowledge, no one ever made it with fresh. But we had a tomato garden in our house when we got our house, and we're like, let's try making it with fresh. And it was a lot of work, and a couple of them were really good, but a couple of them we made with fresh were kind of stinkers. And we were like, overall, the math doesn't add up to get that one great one, but those five cruddy ones. And then our neighbors built a bigger fence and put too much shade for us to grow tomatoes. But anyway, same thing with the cans. We're always pursuing, like, what are the best tomatoes to get? Where can we get what we think are real San Marzano tomatoes? And are they actually better? I'm always reading articles about different canned tomatoes, right? And cost-wise, because we still make it a lot. So we're looking for the big ones that we can buy in bulk, you know, cheap. We don't want to pay $8 for a tiny 16-ounce can, because we will break the bank on that. So we'd much rather get like a giant restaurant size, like, barrel type canned things.
Nice.
Because that's what works out. We make it in big batches.
So you mentioned earlier that you don't like ordering spaghetti and meatballs at a restaurant. And I agree with, like, if you're going to an Italian restaurant, to me, like, ordering spaghetti and meatballs it's like going to a bagel shop and ordering a plain bagel with plain cream cheese. It's like, okay, like, that's probably going to be all right, but that's, like, the most boring choice you could make, and you're probably missing out on much better options.
Well, the other thing is the red sauce, the tomato sauce in Italian restaurants, really hit or miss. Even good Italian restaurants, because the difference is in taste. Some people like it spicy, some people don't. Some people like it bland, some people like lots of oregano, some people like lots of garlic. No, you know, like, there's so much variability, you just don't know what you're getting. So the meatballs are very variable, but even the red sauce is pretty variable in my experience. So I do not order that ever at any Italian restaurant.
Okay, so then my question is, you go to an Italian restaurant, you know it's a pretty good one, what do you order?
When I was a kid, growing up on Long Island, we would go to Italian restaurants all the time, because that's the kind of restaurant my dad liked. And my wife can relate.
I'm shocked.
I like to. the kid thing to get, the thing that I and my siblings always got, and I just associated in my mind, like, this is what kids get at Italian restaurants. I have no idea if this is true, but what we always got was Big Ziti.
Oh, that's a good choice.
All the time. And it came in an oval,
no, it's not,
ceramic thing.
Oh, God, what a waste. Oh, my God.
That's what we did on Long Island. We'd get Big Ziti, right?
So if your children, I understand, children have terrible food at restaurants. What do you order now as an adult?
All right. So as an adult, first of all, I hardly ever see Decent Baked ZD, right? So I don't order that anymore. I still like it. Recently, I was in Colorado visiting my parents, and they have a hard time finding good Italian food there. And they had baked ziti on the menu. My parents said, "Yeah, it's actually what you remember." And I got it like out of pure nostalgia, and it was in the same sort of oval shaped oven safe ceramic thingy on top of another plate because it's super hot with the cheese,
yep.
Really crunchy on it. Like it's good comfort food. So I have ordered that recently, but mostly what I get, my go to is always and everyone's going to hate me for this, but it's the truth, veal parm. I know about the cows. Believe me, my mother is a vegetarian. Every time I ordered veal parm for my entire life, she told me about the poor cows taken away from their mother. I know about the cows. You don't have to tell me. She's literally told me my entire life. The only time I ever get it is at an Italian restaurant. I do get it a lot.
Casey, I'm afraid to ask you.
Oh, if I go to an Italian restaurant, what do I get?
Velveeta
shells and cheese.
Yes.
Oh, if only. Oh, that'd be amazing. I actually had that for dinner last night, coincidentally. No, if I go to an Italian restaurant and do I have to answer this question? I feel
yes,
like,
honestly.
All of a sudden, I feel like, all right. So if I go to an Italian restaurant, in my personal opinion, which the entire internet is now going to write me and tell me how wrong I am, and I don't care. Just save your keyboard fingers. I don't care. Don't tell me. I like lasagna. I like lasagna a lot. I think you can get good lasagnas at a restaurant. You can get bad lasagnas at a restaurant. And I feel like it's a good metric. And so because of that, I will often order lasagna.
It's a little risky, but less risky than spaghetti and meatballs. I was never a big lasagna fan as a kid at restaurants or whatever, but I've been making the Lydia's lasagna recipe at home, and it is amazingly good.
Wait, Lydia's?
You don't know Lydia?
No.
The famous TV chef, Lydia Bastianich, I think her last name is. She's my favorite television Italian chef. I really do like her recipes. She has a lasagna recipe, which is, guess what? Really boring. Like, it is the straightforward, like, this is lasagna. There is nothing weird about it. It is just plain. I make her bolognese recipe, also very straightforward. I just made her bolognese recipe like 2 days ago. She's my favorite, like, other person to get Italian recipes from, because, like, she's from the same sort of, geographic and culinary background as my grandparents, right? New York City, New York metro area, Italian American, same generation of immigrant, more or less. And she makes food like they made food and like I like. And yeah, that's, but Italian restaurants are all sorts of things. I love all kinds of pasta dishes, like all kinds of, like, again, boring pasta dishes. At one of my favorite Italian restaurants, I'll order, pasta with garlic and oil. I'll order pasta with tomato, garlic and oil. Like, just very simple. I love pasta. I'll order that if it's on the menu. Not exciting recipes. It's just a question of something that catches my eye at a particular time. I will wander an Italian menu much more than I will in another restaurant where I feel like there's only a few safe havens.
First of all, that reveals a lot of, like, about your psychology of restaurants, that, like, you look at this as, like, this is a safe haven. Like, I can only order these things that are safe on the menu for things I don't know.
Yeah, well, if you go to a fish place and you don't like fish, you're looking for, like, the one, fish option, or, like, lots of... I'm not particularly adventurous with food, so looking at a menu, there's often very only, like, two or three things that I think I would even potentially like. But in an Italian restaurant, I'll like almost anything that's not fish.
I'm being told by the arbiter that you do indeed order a lot of veal parm, but not as consistently as you used to.
Sometimes it's not always on the menu, and sometimes I have a crisis of faith, and I'm like, this veal parm is not going to be good. I can't order this. I have to, you just don't know. Like, you see it on the menu, but you're like, maybe not.
Does it not bother you, like, when you mentioned a minute ago, like, that you often will just, like, get pasta with, garlic and oil or whatever. Like, does it bother you to order something that you could very easily make at home?
Oh, no, it doesn't bother me at all, because someone else makes it for you. That's what you pay them for. Like, I mean, I will very often complain when I order an exact dish that I make at home, and I order it, and I go, mine is 10 times better than this.
See that? It seems like that's the risk. Like,
yeah.
Ordering, like, a veal parm, that makes sense, because that's something that, like, most home cooks are not going to make, right? Like, that's so that you can...
You're not going to buy veal because you're too guilty in the store, but at the restaurant, I'll do it.
Right, yeah. The restaurant's like, well, you think, well, they already have it back there. I know it's terrible, but... I'll go for, usually if I'm in an Italian restaurant, which honestly isn't that often, but when I'm in an Italian restaurant, I'll usually go for some kind of fancy pasta dish. So, like, maybe a ravioli or a tortellini, or just like a cool shaped pasta, like orecchiette or something, with sausage and vegetables or something like that. Like, some kind of, like, a fairly complex dish. Like, I probably could make this at home, but it would be like a lot of chopping and a lot of steps. So like, I'm probably not going to. And you know, something like that, like fresh flavors, you know, fresh tomato, fresh mozzarella, stuff like that. Like, I wouldn't go for something as simple as just like pasta with, you know, garlic, because I would be afraid of that happening. Of like, I don't want to order something that in this restaurant that I could go make at home for 50 cents that would be better.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I feel like if it just, even if I feel like I could do it slightly better, as long as it's good enough, I'm fine with it. And yeah, it is like a waste of money. We don't go out to eat that often. We very rarely go out to eat. But, and so I don't mind paying $16 for something that costs them 10 cents to make. Like, I don't care. It's fine. That's the whole point of going out. But occasionally, like, one of my favorite things I make at home is like a pasta with sausage and broccoli rabe, which is a combination. That's probably my favorite thing that I make. And lots of restaurants are starting to have it. And I make the mistake of ordering it, and every time I'm disappointed. I'm like, it sometimes it's like, it's okay, but I eat it and I'm like, I just think mine is just so much better. This often because mine is simpler. Like, they add more stuff to it. They put cream or peas in it. It's like, what are you even doing? Like, stick to the basics.
Those are good. Cream and peas and maybe like onions and like prosciutto maybe. Oh man.
I would rather be having my, say, I've ruined my wife with the carbonara. She always asks me to make carbonara, which isn't actually carbonara. It's a modified Lydia recipe that isn't actually called carbonara, but anyway, that's what we call it.
Oh no. You butcher carbonara?
She orders it at restaurants, and then her complaint is always, this is not as good as what we make at home. And so now at this point, she's stopped ordering it. She doesn't do it anymore. She's like, I know I'm going to be disappointed by this. I'm not going
to
order it.
Oh, you're lucky. I've tried to make carbonara a number of times, and I butcher it. It's so bad.
It's my wife's favorite recipe. She periodically gets like uncontrollable cravings for it. It'll be like, I need carbonara today, and so I have to make it for her.
That's actually a good point, is I've forgotten that, you know, for years my go-to was lasagna, as stated earlier, but in the last handful of years I have started getting really into carbonara, and I try not to have it often because it is extremely bad for you.
Food. Oh yeah, but it's horrible.
Oh,
for
man,
you
is it good. Yeah. And Tina is writing me now to say that John's carbonara is awesome, and now I want it. So it sounds like you're making carbonara tomorrow.
I may have triggered it again. Sorry,
you're making carbonara tomorrow, and I'm coming over for dinner because I want some of that.
Yeah next time we're at your house, here's the menu, right? we figured it out.
No, that's the thing about my carbonara though, is even though my wife loves it and I really like it and one of my children will tolerate it, I don't serve it to guests because I assume everyone else will find it just disgusting, because honestly, like, it is disgusting in a unhealthy way, and it is very, what I make is very, it's oppressive. It is like it is heavy. It is, I would never serve it to guests because you'd be like,
that's carbonara. Okay, so normally carbonara, feel free to correct me, normally carbonara is some kind of pasta, often linguine, I think, or whatever the broad version is, usually pancetta, peas, onions, some kind of cream, and egg, right?
You are making the restaurant version of it.
Right. So how does yours differ?
So the, and again, what I'm making is not actually carbonara. Actual carbonara is like Parmesan cheese, egg. You can either do whole egg or just the yolks. And then, you know, spaghetti and black pepper. And that's it. And like no peas, no cream, pancetta or guanciale, right?
All right, wait. I can be talked out of cheese, not peas.
Yeah. So now the peas are not like, go look at like what is traditional carbonara, or go to Italy. Like, you're not going to get cream and peas in it, right? So that's it. That's the basics. And then American restaurants, to try to, you know, kick it up a notch, boom, Amarillo, add all sorts of other crap to it. The cream is in addition to like add to the richness, and I'm sure there's some variation of it in Italy that's like that. But anyway, Italian American carbonara does not have cream, but adding it, it's like it fits. Like, you see how it works with it. Like, and it's cheaper to add cream than to add more Parmesan cheese.
That's why.
What I'm actually making is a variant of Lydia's recipe, which is not called carbonara. I think she calls it like linguine I forget the hell the name of it is. It's some descriptive name that's just like listing the ingredients. I do not add cream, but I do add onions, and I add chicken stock, which is not on the menu, but it's something that I add to my thing. I only use yolks, no whites, and I use way, way too much Parmesan cheese. And the meat has changed. I used to use plain old bacon because it's all we could get when we were in Georgia, and we just kind of stuck with it because, hey, bacon is good tasting, only a specific kind of bacon. Now we switch over to pancetta. I'd use guanciale if you could ever find it, but it's like impossible to find it.
That sounds pretty awesome.
Yeah. So it is not really the reason we call it carbonara is the predominant flavor is Parmesan cheese and egg yolk.
I mean, I'm on board with that, but that is very different than what I envision as carbonara.
Yeah, because you're all thinking of the restaurant one that has cream and peas in it.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, basically add peas to yours and I'm sold.
Yeah, even I just went to our favorite Italian restaurant that we've been going to, you know, since 1994. I don't know how many years that is, but it's a lot. That still exists and is great because they no longer even have a sign on it. Like there's no word on the outside of the restaurant that says the name of the restaurant at all. So
does it say restaurant?
Does says nothing. Literally says nothing. There's no words. But anyway, it's still there. We still go to it, and they make a thing they call chicken carbonara, which has chicken, mushrooms, cream, pancetta, and rigatoni, and it's like. How is that carbonara? I guess because it has the, you know, like it has the pancetta and it has cream and that kind of counts. It's a great meal. I love it. I love the taste of it, but it's just, it's like, it's a restaurant variation.
Yeah.
And it has a cheese on it. And honestly, I think the cream is because it fits in with the richness and it kind of works, but it's much cheaper than adding more of the $21 a pound Parmesan cheese to it.
Similarly, there's an Italian restaurant by me that serves a farfalle carbonara, which seems wrong in every measurable way.
Those are the bow ties, right?
Correct.
Now, see, honestly, I like bow tie pasta for saucy dishes because it picks up the sauce really well.
Mm-hmm. So theirs is described on their menu as chicken sauteed in a cream sauce with prosciutto, peas, and farfalle pasta. And oh, man, it may be like terrible restaurant carbonara, but it is delicious, terrible restaurant carbonara. It is so good.
Yeah, that sounds great. I would probably order that.
Yeah, and the reason my wife doesn't like them is because they're not what she's expecting. She's not expecting cream. And so even though it may be like, oh, this is a good creamy pasta dish, it's not what she wants when she wants carbonara. She wants the thing that I make, which also isn't carbonara. But, you know, anyway, there's probably some good. You can just probably look up Lydia's thing of like watching her make carbonara. There are very few ingredients. It's very simple. It's easy to screw up. You can obviously scramble the eggs, but a little bit of practice, you'll get it. And at least then you'll know, like, this is the base. And then if you want to start adding stuff after that, fine. But I would say draw the line at cream, because if you're adding cream, that's a different thing. Maybe good, maybe great, but just maybe call it something different.
Now I really want carbonara, something awful.
I was just glad you didn't say you put Velveeta in yours.
No. Well, I would never cook it, but...
It just puts it on top at the end.
Yeah, right? Shells and cheese are good, man. Don't knock it till you try it.
I have tried it.
I've tried it.
Oh, it's good.